Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Eastern Bank. Eastern Bank is committed to helping people and businesses prosper, investing over $240 million in local charities since 1994. Eastern Bank. Join us for good. EasternBank.com. Member FDIC.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, Vice President Mike Pence visited the Texas border and said the migrant detention facilities are clean, sanitary, and they're getting three meals a day. Senator Ed Markey goes to the border and says the conditions are enraging, heartbreaking. We'll talk to the senator about what he saw, why he voted against the border spending package, and where he is on impeachment. Then we open the lines and ask you about the House rebuking Trump for his racist rhetoric. Was this a good way to unite the Democrats, or did it simply energize Trump's base?
In 8 days, Encore Boston Harbor made more money than MGM did in an entire month. It also beat MGM on the litigious front, getting slapped with a class action lawsuit. We'll talk to Shirley Young about this and more. Then at noon, national security expert Juliette Kayyem joins us to go over the latest headlines. That's next on Boston Public Radio. Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
You're not going to say it's going to be a scorcher?
Well, it's going to be a scorcher today. I think tomorrow's going to be cool.
Fine.
But Friday, Saturday, and Sunday,
Okay. Scorcher. Sorry I brought it up. It's two tales of one facility. Senator Ed Markey goes to the Texas border. He describes the conditions of the migrant detention centers as enraging and heartbreaking. His colleague, Senator Lindsey Graham, goes to the border, and this is what he sees.
What did I see? 52,000 people have been released into the interior of the United States from this one Border Patrol area alone. What I saw is a bunch of people have been here before, broke the law before, and we're not going to let them go. I don't care if they have to stay in these facilities for 400 days. We're not going to let those men go that I saw. It would be dangerous. All of them broke our law. Many of them have done it before, and we're not going to let them go. This is not a concentration camp that I saw. It is a facility overwhelmed.
Senator Markey joins us on the line to talk about this, Trump's racist tweets, and more. Senator, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Senator, your takeaway from visiting these facilities was far different than Lindsey Graham's. Tell us about what you saw.
Well, I was in three locations. Well, the first one was a facility which is called the Infirmary. It's where they hold the migrants who have been sent there when they have contagious diseases, the flu, chicken pox, other diseases. And then they are put into different secure areas all within the same floor where you can see all of the migrants simultaneously. What I saw was sick toddlers without beds to sleep on. I saw muddy kids without access to showers. I saw them handed towelettes to wash themselves off day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, day six, day seven. No showers for them, just towelettes. I saw in this facility they had no toothbrushes or toothpaste. The Mylar blankets over their heads had to be used in order to keep the lights out. At the second facility, I saw extreme overcrowding. The capacity was 240 at that second facility. It had over 400 people who were being detained inside of that facility. I spoke to asylum seekers who had been in the facility for more than 3 weeks with no timeline for release or transfer. It's supposed to be 72 hours. They're there for 3 weeks and longer. I spoke with a family with two sons from Honduras who left due to violence. And that's why they were there. They were afraid and they did not feel secure in going back to their home. So they had essentially incarceration inside of cells that is like a prison, but worse in many ways because they're not given the kind of sanitary tools, the kind of living standards that would be unacceptable. A federal district court judge, if this was up in Boston, would just come in and just say, shut this facility down until you can provide humane conditions for people.
Senator, you were one of, I think, eight senators who voted against the border funding, $4.5 billion funding bill. Even if imperfect, and I know your words are stronger than that, did you not feel that at least some of that money would go to improving the conditions that you're describing?
Well, my feeling was that these conditions are intolerable, and it's the intent of the Trump administration to keep them in an intolerable condition. That's their plan. The Trump administration's inhumane and hateful assault on immigrants must stop. That's the statement I made with my no vote. But in my opinion, we weren't going to be able to stop it by giving more money to ICE and Customs and Border Patrol to carry out the Trump administration's criminally anti-immigrant agenda of building and deploying a deportation force, separating families at the border, detaining immigrant children in unsafe and unsanitary conditions. So my feeling was we didn't want to perpetuate a system of detention. We needed to have a whole debate about what we are doing in the name of the American people on the border.
You know, about a week or so ago on television, I had two of your colleagues, Congressman Kennedy, who voted yes on the funding bill, and Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who voted no. And I asked them about the motivation to allow this on the part of the Trump administration. And I asked if the color of the skin of the migrants was a prime motivation, meaning had they been white, would Donald Trump treat them like this? And both of them said emphatically race had a huge amount to do with it. Do you agree with them?
I agree with that 100%. The Trump strategy for reelection in 2020 is to engage in a direct message to white, very conservative voters across the country to increase the turnout. And that's why his tweets are racist. That's why his words are racist. That's why his border strategy is racist. It's based upon demonizing people of color in order to turn out his vote amongst white conservative voters across the country. And it's an agenda of hate and division, and it's all meant towards getting him reelected, plain and simple, regardless of what it does to the soul of the United States.
Well, the House now has condemned the president's racist tweets, but what happens now?
Well, I think we should just expect that Donald Trump is going to continue on this strategy. It's going to be the way in which we debate issues for the next year and a half. It's clear that he thinks it was a winning formula back in 2016, talking about the federal judge being Mexican and as a result not being trustworthy, talking about there may be some good Mexicans, but for the most part they're rapists and murderers. So from my perspective, I think Ayanna Pressley is right. I don't think we can take his bait. I think it's key for us to fight him on his racist agenda while also making it clear that we're talking about the fact that he's simultaneously in court right now trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which provides health care for every single American, that he's also hiding the fact that he had a tax break which went disproportionately to the wealthiest people in our country. So we have to do both simultaneously. We can't allow him to poison our political discourse, but we also have to be focusing upon these top-line messages, which are big winners among swing suburban voters in our country, which he is very afraid of.
We're talking to Ed Markey. You know, Senator, I think I read a tweet of yours showing support for the four congresswomen of color who were the victims of this racist attack from the president. But how did you feel about what Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic Speaker of the House, said about the same four women And when she was talking to Maureen Dowd in the New York Times on Sunday, when she says all these people have their public whatever in their Twitter world, but they don't have any following. They're four people, and that's how many votes they got. Pretty disparaging. How'd you react to that?
My feeling is that Donald Trump is a uniter and not a divider. And what he did yesterday was unite the Democratic Party on the floor of the House on the central issue, which is that he is not worthy of being the president of the United States and that all Democrats have to stand united. The scary part was that there was only a small handful of Republicans who are willing to stand up and to call this a racist
four of them, right.
Activity. Yeah. So I think that Donald Trump united the party, and the question shouldn't be whether Democrats agree on everything, but will the Republicans disagree with Trump on anything? And it's a sad commentary on the Republican Party that the vote yesterday once again revealed this incredible total control of the party that was once respectable, but now is just a hand, is just a tool of the Trump re-election agenda.
Should I assume then, when you're talking about the Democrats should be united, that you were critical? I mean, Pelosi essentially criticized the four women for exactly what you did, voting against the funding bill. Was she wrong to call these four women out?
Again, my feeling is that ultimately there was a common goal, which everyone on the Democratic side had, which was to help the people who were in need. There was a difference over tactics in accomplishing that goal. And ultimately, within a couple of days, the Democratic Party reunited, and that was yesterday. So, I'm hopeful that we can stay united now going forward to just focus on the real enemy, which is the racist tactics of Donald Trump to divide our country red and blue, and he believes that gives him a majority, and we just have to work hard to prove that he's wrong.
Of course, the Democrats aren't united on whether or not to impeach the president, Senator Ed Markey. There are numbers of people in the House who think that impeachment is the way to go. Do you think that Nancy Pelosi is right to say, hold off? You know, it's so odd, I think, the dynamics going on here. We have the House chastising the president for his racist remarks. We have all this going on the border, people talking about child abuse at the border at the hands of the administration. We have many other issues that Democrats and some independents are upset about regarding the president. And yet he keeps doing what he's doing. And, it's kind of like, if he's so bad, how come we don't impeach him?
Well, I do think we're on a pathway towards an impeachment process. I think that all of the evidence that was in the Mueller report was devastating. So from my perspective, every day, by his own actions, Donald Trump brings us closer to impeachment. The House and Senate right now is gathering, the Democrats are gathering the evidence and thoroughly compiling the case for it. We need to get the unredacted Mueller report. We need Special Counsel Robert Mueller to testify. We need former White House Counsel Don McGahn to testify. We need former White House Communications Director Hope Hicks to testify. We need the White House to respond to congressional requests for documents and records. And Trump is blocking these testimonies and trying to prevent all the evidence from coming to light. So he's engaged in a cover-up that would make Richard Nixon blush with envy, and his obstructionism is not working. So from my perspective, we need to get the evidence, but we can build the case for impeachment, and the more he obstructs is the more likely he's setting up an impeachment showdown.
You read, based on your comments that I read a week or so ago, you've read the Mueller report, I assume, correct?
Yes.
Have you, based on the reading of the Mueller report itself, are you convinced or do you believe the president has committed impeachable offenses?
I think there's no question that just reading the document and reaching a conclusion from his written text that, yes, that is the case. But Mueller is going to testify next week before Congress. And that's going to be the big moment.
So you're
we're going to be in a situation where we hear from him. But without question, in my opinion, what I read in the Mueller report contained impeachable offenses.
You know, Senator Markey, some of us who are not fans of the president, I'm among them, are looking forward to the testimony. But I'm worried for a couple of reasons. One of them is I'm worried because a lot of times, with all due respect, Senator, you know this, you've been there a long time, these turned into like Democrats and Republicans giving speeches. You know, they get up there and they never even let the person talk because they're so busy with their 5 minutes. Does anybody ever talk about having a litigator come in there that really knows how to ask questions instead of having...
Yeah, the Republicans talked about it Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, well,
that went
not,
well, didn't
she
it?
She was not a good litigator in my estimation. But you know what I mean? I mean, wouldn't that be more effective than everybody just grandstanding? Not everybody, but due respect, Senator, but sometimes it does happen. You know what I'm saying?
No, and I appreciate that. You know, when you look back, it's pretty clear that Barbara Jordan and many others on the House side did a phenomenal job back in the Nixon impeachment proceeding.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, there were special counsels, Sam Dash and others, who were asking questions on the Senate side. So there's... From my perspective, a seriousness of purpose, which an overwhelming number of members actually assume when an impeachment question is being considered. And from my perspective as well, Republicans will try to tear down Mueller, but I believe that Democrats want answers and will ask the questions that Americans want asked, and I think that they will be up to the task.
You know, I want to clarify, just be clear on something, Senator Markey, if I can, is while you said that you do believe that Mueller laid out impeachable offenses, it sounds like you're saying you're not ready to say that impeachment proceedings should begin until you've heard Mueller's testimony. Is that a fair statement of where you are, or what is a fair statement of where you are?
That is correct. I think that the Mueller testimony is going to be, the key historical turning point.
How are you dealing with the fact I interviewed a woman who's already challenged you in the primary about a few weeks ago. She said, by the way, she believed impeachment proceedings should begin now. How are you dealing with a challenge, maybe two, in a primary where it seems, at least from having spoken to this one candidate and read about the other, that they seem to be challenging you from the left, I think, is what they seem to be saying. How are you reacting to the challenge?
Well, my feeling is that the record that I built and the things that I'm fighting for right now are going to be the basis for my candidacy. Our need to fight climate change is central, and with the Green New Deal and partnering with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is the leading edge of this fight to change the way in which we deal with this crisis, saving all of creation by engaging in massive job creation. Our country is facing devastating income inequality and assaults on our democracy literally every day, and I'm not going to back down from those fights or the fights to ensure that we provide the strongest possible gun safety laws to protect everyone in our country and to protect a woman's right to choose and to defend Obamacare and to further extend healthcare benefits to everyone in our country. So that's what I'm going to be running on. And I'm in the Senate to legislate and to agitate. And I do that every single day. I fight Donald Trump every single day. And I'm going to continue to do so every day that I am given the privilege of representing Massachusetts in the United States Senate.
One last thing. By the way, I didn't mean to be disrespectful to the woman who's challenging you. Her name is Shannon Liss Reardon. I didn't mean not to say her name in an intentional way. I just forgot for a second. Before you go, on a much more important note, we hear you are essentially head of the Welcome Committee for Enes Kanter, who will be playing for the Boston Celtics. Is that correct?
I think he is a great basketball player, and I think we're lucky to have him. But I also think that when Erdogan, the leader of Turkey, calls him a traitor, and that Enes Kanter is afraid to travel outside of our country, that it's important for us to stand up for him and to let him know that we in Boston will have his back. And I wanted to make it very clear to him that he had a friend in Boston who was willing to be someone who would welcome him with open arms, and that we would be a community that will be inspired by his excellence and his advocacy in the face of an authoritarian intimidation that is coming out of Turkey towards him, which potentially endangers his life.
Well, if he can block shots, he'll have a huge number of people welcoming him. Senator, we really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Senator Markey, for calling in.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Ed Markey is a United States Senator from Massachusetts, a member of the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, and he tweets at Sen Markey. Up next, we open the lines and ask you about the House rebuking President Trump for his racist rhetoric. Was this a good way to unite the Democrats, or did this just energize Trump's base? That's next on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browning, Marjorie Egan. Yesterday in the House, a resolution was passed condemning Trump last night for his racist rhetoric, telling four congresswomen of color, as you know, now known as the Squad, to go back to where they came from. The measure was approved, mostly partisan line vote, 240 to 187, four Republicans and one former Republican, now an independent, joined the Democrats. We're opening the lines only briefly, asking you, is this good for the Democratic Party, uniting them, as I guess Ed Markey suggested, or do they just energize Trump's base? 877-301-8970. As we know, Nancy Pelosi has basically said she's not going to lead an impeachment fight yet for strategic reasons. Was it strategically wise for the Democrats to take this vote last night? Again, strictly, virtually, unanimously along party lines. 877-301-8970. What do you think, Marjorie, before we get to the goals?
You know, he's the president of the United States. He told four women of color to go back to the countries they came from. It's a longtime racist trope. I think you can't. I mean, I think you have to do it.
You have to vote?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah, you do. You have to say that there are Democrats who think this is disgraceful.
Do we know that Democrats thought it was disgraceful, think it was disgraceful before? Do we know that virtually every Democrat thought it was disgraceful before? I assume the purpose was
because
to put the Republicans on the defense of the vote.
I think if you don't do this, it normalizes really horrific behavior, which is what we keep doing.
So wait a second. So by taking the vote, it doesn't normalize it? What did it achieve, I guess, is my question. Obviously, I totally agree with the sentiment. They were racist comments. Virtually everybody
in
America's...
What's the alternative?
To condemn him like they've done in their speeches. They don't condemn every tweet that comes out of this guy's phone. I just think, you know, it's just odd for me for a woman who has decided that even though she thinks he self-impeaches, to quote her, every single day, who will not start an impeachment proceeding, she does feel a need to pass a resolution that has no impact, no binding impact on something that is obvious that the president made a grotesquely racist comment about these four women of color.
I think Nancy Pelosi is making a mistake not to begin impeachment proceedings, and we'll see what happens after Robert Mueller testifies last week. I'm not optimistic about Robert Mueller's testimony based on what I've read about his him and his performance the last time, but we'll see.
Okay, we only have a few minutes for this, as I said, but let's focus on last night's vote by the Democrats, essentially, in the House of Representatives. Brunier, you're first in Hyde Park. Welcome to the show. Hi, Brunier.
Good morning, guys. I'm so mad at everybody. Even at Markey, I'm mad. I mean,
why?
Well, first of all, he's so euphoric. He sounds like a sleeping pill. You're talking to him. He speaks like somebody who speaks English as a second language. He's not. He's taking his time to speak because he's too careful. Democrats are too careful. Ed Markey is an articulate guy. He's like slow, taking his time to talk because he's afraid of what he's going to do. Democrats need to stop playing defense. We need fighters.
Okay? What were they fighting last night? Did they satisfy your fighting need last night with this resolution, Bernier?
Satisfied. I might as well go drink some water in the gutter. These people are not satisfying anything here. They need to start impeachment proceeding yesterday. Nancy Pelosi needs to go. I'm serious. Because how could you say Trump has violated the law and still you're saying, well, you know, he needs to self-impeach, as much you just said. It makes no sense.
So wait a second. Before you go, is he a sexist dog like I apparently am? Because I think Nancy Pelosi... I thought Nancy Pelosi should not be re-elected as Speaker, Marjorie. You going to call him a sexist dog, too?
Who, Bernier?
He said Nancy's got to go.
No, I love Bernier. I don't think you're a sexist dog, Bernier. I hear
as
stories about you.
Jim Browdy.
I hear you're legendary in the neighborhood.
Bernier, thank you as always. We really appreciate your call. We're short on time. Pam from Worcester, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi.
I think they did. It's the very least they could do. The very least they could do. I think they had to do it. Just the temperature. Imagine what all of the minority people in our country are facing to not say something.
Well, so if you say that, if Pam, if you say it's what they had to do, then compare if you can. Nancy Pelosi says the president's committed impeachable offenses. How did they not have to start impeachment then if she's convinced that he is?
They do.
Oh, they do. Oh, okay.
They do. They have to.
So you're saying that she should move on both fronts. Not last night was good,
absolutely.
But I got it. Okay, Pam, thank you.
Well, I guess we have to hope that Robert Mueller is up to his game next week, because if you do read the Mueller report, you know it is devastating, and the Russian stuff is devastating. Although there's not a conspiracy, that's absolutely true. There is deep shenanigans going on between the Russians and the Trump campaign at a million different levels, and it's really frightening. Anyway, John from Gardner, what do you think, John?
Hi, John.
I think I've been yelling at my TV more the last two nights than I did all nine Patriots Super Bowls. You should hear, and I must have been in a particularly self-abusive mode the night before last, because I not only watched their news program like I do every evening, but I even tuned into a couple of their folks between 8 and 11.
Oh, Fox?
Fox? Yeah.
Oh, what'd they say?
What do you think? I'll tell you the strategy right now. It's turning it all around, and it begins with Fox and the Republic. They're one and the same. Turning this all around so that the Dems are always playing racial politics. The Dems are always playing the racial card. Everything's racist with them. They're pointing out how, not in their words, and I think AOC did phrase that poorly when she, but they're saying that she called Nancy Pelosi a racist. And then the next thing you know, they're calling Biden a racist. And now they're calling Trump. They're saying that everybody in the Dem side is calling everybody a racist. They're trying to blunt Trump's crap by doing that.
Hey, John. Just,
but what do you think?
John,
sorry, go ahead.
I just want a quick aside.
Oh, Fox News?
Are you watching The Loudest Voice in the Room, the Showtime film was starring Russell Crowe as Roger Ailes?
Apparently nobody's watching it.
Apparently nobody's.
I'm behind in the... I didn't watch the last one, but I am recording that.
Oh, my God. The last one you'll love.
I know you're going to run. I think we want our young people to be passionate. We want our elder statesmen and folks to be wise and sage and strategic. At least I do. I think Ayanna and the other three came out and said they weren't going to feed. Then they fed. And I just think I don't know. We got to find a way to not put down the passion of those young folks and others, but we got to be wise and strategic, in my opinion. And I don't think impeachment, just for the simple fact it's not going to work. We got to concentrate on a good they have to concentrate on a good message to win the election.
John, thanks for the call. You know, before we leave this, Marty, we're going to talk to Juliet Kayyem about it a bit at noon as well. Is it possible that the reason Nancy Pelosi did this, I hadn't thought of this until John from Gardner was speaking, was because she was getting so much blowback for her comments in the Maureen Dowd column criticizing the same four women, that she saw an opportunity when Trump made his racist statement about the same four women to quickly criticize him, which in essence is coming totally to their defense in an attempt to blunt the criticism she's gotten, which she has, from what I understand,
well,
about her comments about them, which I thought was totally uncalled for.
That could be
in the Maureen Dowd column.
That could be, and it's also, remember, she was pretty friendly with AOC when AOC first got there. They had that rapprochement.
Not last week.
But well, it kind of the beginning. I'm talking about months
ago.
Yeah,
I understand that.
So maybe it was a way too to get back to kind of mend the fence after that Maureen Dowd column.
But again, I think this it's a tough question how Nancy Pelosi thought strategically that was good last night, but starting impeachment proceedings is strategically unwise. I'd love to hear her explain that when she has her weekly or whatever press conference.
Well, up next, we're going to change topics, open the lines. No, that's not what we're doing. We're talking to Shirley Leung. We opened the lines just now.
Good.
We're going to talk to Shirley Leung about a bunch of things, including in 8 days, the Encore Casino has brought in more cash than MGM did in an entire month. Will Encore continue to win big? The Boston Globe's Shirley Leung joins for that. And this really neat idea about avoiding the waters rushing over the Seaport District of South Boston. All that is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. We know that behind every great man, there's a great woman. Well, it turns out that behind that giant leap for mankind, there were thousands of women. In her latest column in the Globe, Shirley Leung, I love this column, writes about how they helped to make the moon landing possible. Shirley is the business columnist for the Boston Globe and a GBH contributor. Shirley, it's nice to see you.
Hi.
Well, a lot of us went and saw that great movie featuring all the African-American women that were the great mathematicians.
You mean The Hidden Figures?
The Hidden Figures,
Well, you may remember that there's a great radio show which interviewed
the
author.
Catherine Johnson. We had her in here. And
No. Catherine Johnson is one of the women. We interviewed...
The author?
The author. The
author
woman who wrote Hidden Figures.
Name?
I think the author was Catherine, too, wasn't she?
No, it was a different name.
I'll think of it in a second.
Margot something.
Margot Lee
whatever.
Shutterly.
Yeah, oh,
okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. We did very well on that.
Thank
anyway.
You. No, I did. You didn't. Go ahead.
We saw Catherine Johnson. Okay, she was one of the chief people featured in that movie. But there were lots of other women that I had no idea about.
Right. I mean, I think so Hidden Figures was out in 2016. It was a great movie, and it shone a spotlight on the three African-American women who I think they were all mathematicians,
yes,
and working at Langley at Virginia.
Called computers.
Computresses.
No, I think they may have been
computers,
called
computers. Right, yes.
I think
they were
called computers.
Back then, computing was considered women's work because back then, this was before electronic computers, they had to do manual calculations. So it was very tedious work. So it was not uncommon. It was not uncommon for women to major in math and compute. And so when Kennedy, President Kennedy in 1961, put out a call, challenged America to put a man on the moon, all these women who were math majors suddenly got recruited to work for NASA or affiliated labs and centers. And I think what's so interesting is that in this celebrating the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 this week, you realize there were thousands of women from Cambridge, here in Cambridge, all the way to California, to Houston, Ohio. There are all these centers and employing many, many women doing all kinds of, engineering and computing work.
And you talked to some of them.
I did.
I love this.
Yes.
I really totally loved it.
It's great because I talked to one of the women, Sadine Zeldin. She worked at the MIT Instrumentation Lab. She worked there I think she was hired in 1966. She's 26 years old, and MIT Instrumentation Lab later spun off to become Draper. But she was incredible. She recalled, working all the time, nights and weekends. They were mission driven. They really wanted to send a man into, a man on the moon. And she also worked with another woman, Margaret Hamilton, who headed the software engineering division for the lab. And they both worked on kind of software modules, helping the plane, the in-flight software, helping astronauts you know, I think enter or exit the lunar orbit. I'm probably mixing it up, but they did some pretty technical stuff.
Something to do with lunar orbit.
Exactly. But she was incredible talking to her. She's now, I believe, retired in Maine. Margaret is still here in Cambridge. But incredible. They told about bringing their kids into the labs on the weekends.
I know, it's great.
And can I tell the Margaret Hamilton
Absolutely,
story?
Yes.
So Margaret, one time she brought her daughter Lauren into the lab, and they have a simulator. And her daughter loves to play astronauts. She was just pushing buttons, boop, 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 boop. And then she made the simulator crash. And Margaret was like, that's not supposed to happen. You know, what if an astronaut made the same mistake, just push the wrong button, and an mission would have to be aborted? So she suggested to NASA that, when the Apollo 11 goes to the moon, maybe we need to build a system in which when an alarm goes off, it seems like there's a malfunction, the computer can figure out, is this the type of malfunction that should abort the mission? Or it's a type of malfunction that we can continue with the mission, we can figure it out. And so I think she actually had to fight for this change in the software, and she finally did get it. And sure enough, if 3 minutes before the Eagle, yes, that's the lunar module, was landed, the alarm started going off. And if Margaret had not written that piece of code, they would have aborted the mission.
Wow.
And so
it gives me chills, by the way.
Isn't it amazing?
It is just great. You know, so, by the way, the fact that technology, and I've thought it a lot this week, like everybody else in America has, when I was reading your column, the technology was so incredibly primitive.
Yes.
The fact that they pulled this off is just
it's amazing.
Amazing.
You know why I'm so glad you wrote this column? Because there have been so many stories on, this week and the anniversary.
About the astronauts and Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin.
But not
Aldrin
just that. You see all the guys in the control room. And everybody's white. Everybody's got a little thin tie on, a little short sleeve
Malcolm
white
X glasses,
shirt.
Right?
Like Malcolm X glasses, smoking cigarettes.
Right, exactly.
You know, there's not a woman in the room.
Right.
So it's so neat to know.
Yeah, there are literally thousands of women behind the scenes. And there were some women. There was, I think, Poppy Northcutt is her name. She was the first female engineer on Mission Control in Houston. Another woman, Joanne Morgan, she was the lone woman in the firing launch room down at the Kennedy Space Center. And you can actually, when they show photos of the firing launch room, you can actually see her in the photo.
Oh my
surrounded
gosh.
By all the men in white shirts and skinny black ties. And there she is in the middle. And so it was great. I'm not a
spaceophile.
Yeah, spaceophile. So I, of course I wouldn't know their stories, but I also interviewed Lori Leshing, who is the president of Worcester Polytechnic Institute. Now, she is a space scientist, and she didn't know a lot of these stories either. And she was saying she was too young. I mean, she's probably in her early 50s, so she was too young to remember watching the moon landing and having the impression. Her kind of real first impression, her first female role model was in 1983 when Sally Ride, American astronaut Sally Ride, when it became the first American woman to be in space. So it was a lot. So I interviewed Lori because I wanted her. She was saying that we need these role models. So it's really amazing to see. It's not just me. Other media outlets, too, are highlighting the contributions of women on the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11.
We're talking to Shirley Leung from the Boston Globe. So Marjorie's former colleague at the Boston Herald, Jerry Callahan, who has been a morning show co-host on WEI, one of the sports stations.
I knew him a million years ago.
20-some years.
We talked about writing columns.
His contract was not renewed the other day. I haven't had to be candid. I used to listen to EI on my way in the morning when Kirk Minahan was there, and love him or hate him, the guy was really talented at radio. He got fired or left or whatever you want to call it now.
In the fall.
Right. And now he's on Barstool Sports, which is another controversial place. And you were not their favorite person at the time.
No.
Because you were essentially through
still
your column.
Still not their favorite person.
Leading a, urging people to boycott the station because of some racism there. You talked to advertisers. When I started listening again the last couple of days after Callahan was let go to see what the reaction was. I want to talk about that in a second. But both there briefly and online on social media, you are named a lot. How do you react? I mean, named a lot meaning It's because of Sam Kennedy, who I happen to think the world of, the president of the Senate's duplicity. Some people argue, I think Minahan may have argued that himself. It's because of Shirley Leung's activism. It's because of the listener who has a transgender son who led a campaign against him. What's your take on all this?
Well, first of all, I think it's what's lost in all of this. It's the ratings, stupid. I mean, right before Callahan was let go, before they the day before they said they were not renewing his contract, there were stories saying that the show was it Mutt? What is it called? Callahan and Mutt, or the morning show?
Mutt and Callahan.
Had fallen
Mike Manansky
fifth,
was his
fifth place.
Yeah.
Do you think if they were, and two springs ago, that show, the morning show with Kirk and with Jerry, number one. Mm-hmm. Do you think if that show was number one, they would have let Jerry go?
I'm so glad. I think the answer is an unequivocal no.
Yeah, and so to say it's me. I mean, I wrote a few handful of columns. I think it was a confluence of events, all I did was highlight and remind people of the behavior of the station and raising the question: why are advertisers still supporting this station? When you read what both of them have done in the past in terms of sexist, racist comments, it's unbelievable they were still there. So all I did was just raise the question, and I didn't write that many columns, and so I can't speak for the activists.
But
in
you
the
did
suburbs.
Reach out to advertisers.
I did. I didn't tell them to boycott. All I did was raise the question: do you know that this happened on the station, and if you do know, why do you keep supporting it? That's all I did.
But you know what I wondered? Is fifth that bad? I mean, I don't think fifth
well,
is
when
that
you've been
bad.
Tied for first, or when Minahan was there, they were actually beating the Sports Hub with Toucher and Rich a lot of that. I mean, I hate to say this because I almost never criticize other people on the radio, but and I'll say this as mildly as possible. The guy they replaced Minahan with is just not a big market kind of guy.
Why didn't they get someone else to go with Callahan?
I think that's the big mystery. I mean, the reality is there always
been there for 20
really
years
strong
huge
personalities. It was John Dennis, he used to be a TV mm-hmm. sports reporter, and Callahan starting the thing. Mm-hmm. And then there was Minahan, who really is, I mean, he is brilliant at radio. He really has a talent. And they replaced him with a guy who everybody tells me, I've never met him, is a very decent guy who's just, I mean, he's not talented.
I think also what's interesting about what's happening at WEI is who they've replaced Jerry with. Greg Hill,
who's
Greg
by Hill. The way, is fabulous. I mean, he's not a sports guy as such.
Right. So I think that's what's really interesting.
Well,
but he was from a sister station, but he does do a lot of
WAAF. But let me just say, if you remember, EEI was rescued and, I would argue, started its couple of decades of wild success with a guy who was not a sports guy in the morning also. We worked with him in later years, Don Imus. Imus was a morning show there.
Oh, really?
Ages, wasn't he
at
there?
At WEI?
Wasn't he there? Am I wrong about that?
I only listen to WGBA.
Oh, actually,
so
I am.
I'm not really
I take
sure.
it back. I take it back. I'm wrong about that.
You're
my
wrong?
Apologies about that.
Well, I guess I'm saying is that WEI.
But Greg Hill,
known
the fact
for
that he's not a primary sports
right,
guy.
Right, exactly. I think it's really interesting.
He knows sport. I mean, by the way, the head shaving thing. I do all the time, you know, with
Greg
Baker
Hill.
And others. Greg Hill is always there. He broadcasts from there. Yeah. He does talk about sport. He's a multi-issue kind of show.
Yeah.
But Curtin Callahan was almost no sports anyway.
Right.
I mean, the vast majority of what they did was politics and culture stuff.
I mean, I don't listen to the competitor. I don't listen to any sports radio, but I think the Sports Hub probably has sports on it, right? And so it's really interesting that when you bring back the new morning show, it's not sports head to head. It's more of more general news talks. I mean, Greg Hill has Charlie Baker on his show.
He does
too,
monthly.
Right?
I wish we had Charlie Baker on monthly. By the way,
no, we used
we're
to.
Supposed to be, but it doesn't happen quite
but,
as much.
But I was also happy to see there will be a woman on the morning. I think he's bringing along his sidekick. Is it Danielle Murr, right? Is that her name?
Yeah, he is. By the way, Imus, of course, I'm sorry, I'm so confused. Imus was on EEI, and then ultimately he ended up going to our old station.
Correct.
When Imus left, that's when, I believe, was the timing when Dennison Callahan came. But I agree with you, by the way, despite all the recriminations, blaming you, blaming this, when ratings drop, fifth is not so bad, but fifth is not so good.
People be thrilled
when you're number one in the market. Yeah. And you drop the fifth,
again,
that means
yourself,
you shed advertisers.
Right, but as we know, Jim, one of the things that helps on the radio is if you have a rapport with your co-host. I like to think most days we have rapport with each other.
Sometimes
we do, some days we don't. But anyway, that's what surprises me, as we said before. Okay, Minahan's gone. You're going to find someone else.
Yeah, I don't understand that. No one has ever explained that to me.
I went through every man in Boston before I ended up with him.
By the way, that happens to be true. In any case, so that's
it's a wild spree.
Can we talk Encore for a second? Bob DeSalvio joined me the other night. He was kind enough to join me, the president of Encore Boston Harbor. They had, and I had asked them, what are the numbers? This is only a couple weeks in. They hadn't had them yet. The first week numbers, and I don't know how aberrational it is, first week numbers were stratospheric. The Globe reported that their first week, they actually took in more than MGM Springfield took
almost as much.
I'm sorry. That's right. 20 million versus 16.8. Yeah. Now, of course, it's Boston, and of course, it is the first week. But they seem, other
it's
than
still
being
amazing.
Sued for something we'll talk about in a second, it's an amazing start.
It's still
start,
an amazing haul. I'm reminded that MGM Springfield also had a terrific first week. And so, I mean,
it did.
And so, because everyone's excited, and there's a lot of advertising and promotion. Everybody wants to check out the new casino. And certainly, there are not that many Encores or Encores in the world. I mean,
That many casinos in Boston either, like none.
Right. But in terms of, a Wynn Resorts casino, it's just Vegas and Macau and now Boston and or Everett, I should say. And I mean, I remember someone was telling people like had relatives like flying in just to see the opening. So it was exciting.
No, we
for
told you. The first person we met, we went to the casino.
It was funny.
Was a young Asian guy. And I only mention that he's Asian is because he went out of his way to say my parents flew in. And he made a comment himself about how Chinese people, they really love this kind of stuff.
Didn't they fly in from China?
No, not from China. They flew in from another location in the United States.
Oh, I thought they came in
but
from China.
But they still did fly
That's too
in
bad.
To
that
go
That would be
to
a much
the,
better story if they flew all the way from China.
How much is this? The suit is that the return that in terms of the slot machines, when you cash out, they round it to the nearest dollar, so you're losing change.
Yeah.
And they talk about the odds, I think, on roulette or something. I don't know enough about it to know.
I had no idea that this was regulated. The odds were regulated.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was fascinating that this was happening. And I wanted to learn more about, I don't know if this happens all the time or if people sue Encore for this, what they were doing. I didn't even know how, it was fascinating to
me. The other question is, because I don't know enough about this either, we should talk to a gambling expert, is does the average person who goes and loses maybe $100 or whatever, does he or she care about what the odds are? I mean, you know, it's not going to have a huge impact. Or do they? I have no idea what the impact is.
Now that I know it's regulated, now I care about it. Yeah. You know, I thought it was random or luck, but it's very regulated. And so, and that would explain why some of the, when you look at some of the revenues, you know, slots versus, I don't know, it was all slots versus the table games and also the payouts. And so it seems to seem there is some kind of formula involved. So I was going to say one more thing about Encore I thought was really interesting that my colleague John Chesto pointed out in his story about the numbers is that Encore is the revenue was almost 50-50 table games versus slots.
Is that so?
Yeah, it's about 45% table games, whereas typically in the casinos in Connecticut and New York, it's 80% slots and 20%
table games. I want to get to the South Boston in a second, but let me ask you quickly. There was a lot of talk about the appeal of Boston, world-class city, you could argue whether it is or it isn't, people coming in from elsewhere that wouldn't be flying in to go to Springfield, and that there was more of an international kind of appeal to this casino. Is that we don't maybe know yet?
I don't think they've quite started. I do think there will be an international appeal. Again, only three cities in have a Wynn Resorts, and so I think that we already get a lot of travelers from Asia, particularly
China.
Which
is a more serious gamble. Gamblers yes. would be on the tables as opposed to the slot
yes,
machine.
Yes, right. So that's what's significant about the statistic is that table games means that there's more high rollers coming
yeah,
in.
Yeah, that's what
and
I thought.
And so, as I understand, I don't think they've quite started advertising to their big Asian whales. They're the, you know, what they call the high rollers there. Because, and this is what the Matt Maddox, the Wynn Resort CEO, said at the opening, which is he thinks it'll take 2 or 3 months to work out all the service kinks. So they don't want to bring in, their best customers until
everything is perfect.
Exactly.
Well, I know you do, but just 10 more seconds on this. The other issue that should be researched at some point, do those whales, as you call it, do they want big name entertainment at the casino also, which they will not get. They can get in Boston, but that's also.
But if they're from Asia, you need big name Asian entertainment.
Well, whatever.
That's
right.
And
okay.
You know, they go to Foxwoods. Years ago, they bring in some of the biggest Asian stars.
Okay, we're almost out of time here, so I want to get to this story. Tell us what's going on with this, the high seas, rising seas, and plans for South Boston Seaport, where they're going to be underwater pretty soon.
Yeah, this is a video from a developer, I think, is at the old L Street Power plant. And I feel like this should be required viewing for all those who do not think that that we're facing a climate crisis. This video showed...
It's great.
Well, one of the things is that it shows that how the sea would be rising over 30 years. And one of the things that this developer is doing, and Mayor Walsh wants to do this too, is to build basically... I don't know if it's parks or like it looked like a lot of greenery, right?
Yeah, like marshland,
right? Buffers, exactly. Kind of thing,
right? Yeah. As buffers, because eventually, instead of building the building up into the water, you fill in with land. You basically build land. You put land, you put shrubbery on it, you put greenery on it, and then eventually, over 30 years, when the seas rise, you're not flooding buildings. You're just covering this new land that you built.
With these cool walkways over the water.
By the way, we should say this video, which is like 30 seconds long, is a time-lapse video, which is great. And you know what I loved about this?
You can see it online. L Street Resilient Landscape Video.
The guy who wrote the story, Tim Logan, is responsible for my favorite photograph.
That's right.
He took a photograph and put it on Twitter, 6 or 8 months ago? Or a year ago.
A year ago, I think it was,
This is the site where the new GE headquarters, which is not going to be built, as it turns out, right?
Well, there will be a build. GE won't be building a headquarters there, but somebody else will be building something.
And he has a picture of it, and it's totally underwater.
It is.
It's like
there is a plan for that 4-point
channel.
There is a plan for buffers down there. So.
Well, it's a neat thing to see. Again, the name of it is the L Street Resilient Landscape
video.
Shirley Leung, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
She joins us every week. Shirley Leung does business columns for the Boston Globe and a WGBH contributor. Up next, national security expert Juliette Kayyem is here to go over the latest headlines. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, where Trump's immigration raids more like waiting for Godot instead of the Iceman cometh. In a few minutes, we'll talk to Juliette Kayyem about the administration's scare tactics. Will this deter future migrants or just drive the undocumented people living here to live underground? Then we talk to food writer Corby Kummer about a Michelin chef's epic meltdown over cheddar cheese and how Arby's roast beef is roasting vegans with their meat-based vegetables.
Is rent control the best way to make housing affordable, or does it make inequality worse? MIT economist John Gruber joins us to talk through the pros and cons. Then Harvard historian Nancy Kane talks over the hazards of multitasking, from our personal wellness to public health. Then we open the lines and ask you, are you ready to go to KonMari on multitasking and embrace the life of a monotasker? That is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. After touring two extremely overcrowded and unsanitary migrant detention centers in McAllen, Texas, where close to 400 men were crammed into a cage, here's what the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence, had to say.
The facility here at McAllen is at the very center of the crisis on our southern border. And this facility here today, while it's clean and sanitary, is doing their level best to deal with this unprecedented flow. Last month alone, nearly 100,000 people coming across our border, individuals being apprehended, families that are presenting, making an asylum claim, and some that aren't. But what you saw today firsthand was the overcrowding that we knew that we would see.
So if the Trump administration expected to see this level of overcrowding at the border, why is there a crisis to begin with? It's a question Juliet Kayyem raises in a terrific piece she wrote for The Washington Post. Juliet is a faculty chair of the Homeland Security Project at Harvard's Kennedy School, former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, and an analyst for CNN. Juliet, it's nice to see you.
Nice to see you both. I should warn everyone, I had dental surgery this morning,
I
sound normal, if I start
Your face.
Really?
Oh, my God.
I'm swollen.
I'm kidding. I mean,
I don't know what it's a thing.
Can I tell you a great story?
If I start slurring, just like, you know, snap or something.
I was on, like drooling. You know,
God.
When I was on NECN in my future, a former life, I did live television all the time there. I had a tooth pulled. And at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and my show, I think, was on at 8 at that time. And I was amazed. We had a backup because I wasn't sure if I was going to swell up.
Yeah.
And I didn't. And I start doing the show at 8. And I look perfectly like normal, like I look. And at 8:10, my producer is not quite yelling in my ear, but saying in my ear, and we went to a commercial break because we actually have commercials in that day, and I looked like a chipmunk.
Oh, really? It was like a late
delayed reaction.
It was a delayed kind of.
Oh, my God.
That's
no,
a
it's
great
just,
story, Jim.
I know.
Thank
okay.
You for
Let's
me.
Move on.
I'm just saying.
From our dental
okay,
issues.
You're saying.
Because. Breaking news here.
Yes.
This Representative Al Green from Texas is trying to force a vote on impeachment today. Unclear what the House is going to do with it.
Yeah.
But he cited the and he is a man. I'm not familiar with this guy. He is a man of color. He's I don't know if he's what his deal is. But anyway, in any case, he cited Trump's racist remarks about four Democratic congresswomen as cause for his seeking his removal from office. So I don't know what this means or what's going to happen or what.
Yeah, it's hard to know what this means in terms of the overall strategy. Mueller is testifying next week on Wednesday. Of course, you have the tweets from this weekend. You have contempt citations against Barr and others regarding the census case. So there's all sorts of issues percolating and sort of sounds like Representative Green sort of thought, I'm going to get ahead of this. But the vote, remember, the vote can just be to table it so that it's merely in existence and that Nancy Pelosi just gets all the Democrats to vote. Let's just table it.
Send it to a committee, that essentially
or whatever.
Means, which means it'll come up if and
when
she ever
wants it to come up. They don't
to.
Have the vote still. They have a lot of representatives supporting impeachment proceedings. Joe Kennedy being, you know, I think one of the more surprised ones in terms of him not known for, you know, I mean, I think him turning, I think, was a big deal because people really do value his judgment. And so, but I don't think they have the votes yet. So Nancy Pelosi will be able to table this. But I think it is a larger sign that the baseline now is impeachment or no impeachment, that it's we're beyond Mueller, we're beyond let the courts decide. We're starting to hear or see some proof that Barr is working his magic, that some of the cases against the president are being shut down, some of the federal cases in New York in particular.
And the Southern District of New York.
Southern District of New
so
York.
So that is succeeding.
I think that Barr's what you can tell just on the timing is about 4 months ago, it appeared that the case stopped, that no more discovery was being taken, no more filings were being made. 4 months ago marks when Barr came in. So look, I mean, the wheels of justice can only grind if there's a case.
Hold on for a second. I'm interested in I always criticize people in politics if they're only concerned about reelection and they do terrible things, like I would say a lot of Republicans did yesterday when they didn't vote with the Democrats on this racist language of the president. But in the Southern District of New York, you have lawyers who have law degrees,
yes,
who could go out and get another job at a corporate firm and make $500,000 a year.
Right.
So are they going to
half a million? Yeah.
Okay. 2 million, whatever
yes,
they
two
make.
Million.
So they're going to now be co-opted by the attorney general? They're going to do his bidding?
Well, in this instance, they may, but there may be other cases that they are able to proceed on, so they think it's worth staying. But something definitely interesting is going on at the Southern District of New York.
But I mean, if something is going on in the Southern District of New York that they think is unethical,
yeah,
they are people that are in the position that they could get out and hold a press conference.
Yeah, but can I wait? I said this the other day, and maybe it was to you, Juliet. I don't know enough to render a total verdict on the Southern District of New York, but the guy who's the U.S. attorney there is this guy Berman,
yes,
who's a friend of Trump's. Remember, speaking of ethics, he recused himself in the Michael Cohen investigation, mm-hmm, because of his relationship with Donald Trump, which is the right thing to do. He indicted a former friend, for lack of a better expression, of Donald Trump, which I'm sure did not make Donald Trump happy,
right,
Jeffrey
we all
Epstein.
We saw pictures of Epstein and Trump
right,
on television,
which
morning.
Obviously casts a negative light on Donald Trump. I don't know how negative it should be. We don't know his level of involvement with Epstein or his relationship was. He now says I was not a fan of his. And the reason I bring that up in defense of Berman, those are at least two acts that are the right acts on the merits, neither of which probably pleased the President of the United States. So I'm not convinced that the Southern District post Preet Bharara, I'd prefer to have him be the U.S. attorney, but I'm not convinced it's totally a captive.
Yeah, that's
Bill
well,
Barr
I,
and
I
the
hope
president.
I hope it's not, because that is extremely
horrific. I would reserve judgment. All we know is that some of these cases seem to have gone dormant.
I agree with that.
And we should just keep watching. But from the House's perspective, the notion that this is going to be resolved through court cases, I think, has always been a fiction. The notion that this was going to be resolved by Mueller has always been a fiction. The question is, you know, a combination of high crimes and misdemeanors with, is he suitable? Is he of sound mind? Is he of sound principle to be the president of the United States? All of us have answers to that question, I think, individually. And now the question is that should that lead to impeachment proceedings?
So we're talking to Juliet Kayyem. You know, Juliet, on a related note, Marjorie and I talked very briefly to our listeners, and apologies, just schedule was tight in the first hour, about whether or not strategically Nancy Pelosi made the right move last night by bringing this resolution to condemn the president for his racism to a vote. People know there was an objection from the Republicans, because the rules in the House
from 1801,
don't allow for
it's
you
so
to criticize, personally attack a fellow member or the president of the United States.
Yeah.
The rules were suspended on a vote, and then with four Republicans and what's his name, the guy from Michigan who just became
Amish.
Five votes, four Republicans, one former Republican, and all the Democrats on one side, all the other Republicans another. Did that achieve? I mean, I want to be clear here so I don't get an angry email. What the president said is unqualifiedly racist. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about was, for a woman who is very strategic, obviously that's why there's not an impeachment proceeding pending. She thinks it's strategically unwise. Nancy Pelosi, was it strategically wise to have this vote yesterday?
Yes.
Why?
I think absolutely.
Why?
You want the vote because making a statement about what the president did as a whole, whether it's a partisan divide or not, I think is essential for Congress to do, especially in the absence of the impeachment proceedings. But I think that there's a larger statement here I've been thinking a lot about, is that I think the outside world is watching, right? So our allies, our enemies, they see a president who, you know, no mincing words here, you know, is a racist. This debate that the media is having about whether to call it racism or not, I was like, I think we all grew up knowing that when you tell someone to go back to their country, that's racism. Like, and that person is, maybe if that person only said something like that once in their lifetime, you might not call them a racist. But the cumulative evidence about who Donald Trump is, it seems undeniable, or it is undeniable to me, that I'm very comfortable saying he is a racist. The outside world is watching. I think Nancy is very, very plugged into ensuring that the world, especially our allies, know that this is a fist fight. That, in other words, the silence, at least legislatively, I think would have been viewed in a certain way. So I'm glad she did it. I like that the world knows that there's divided government and that a large majority, or all Democrats and a few Republicans, which is not nothing, are willing to say that the president of the United States made a racist statement, and that the Republicans are on record when they go into their elections in 2020 not having voted for this resolution. And that's what clearly she's aiming at.
You know, there's one last related note that Marjorie pointed out to me that I really want to point out, and I admire the reporter, one of your colleagues, Manu Raju.
Oh, wasn't that a great line of questioning?
Who's the congressional reporter for CNN, chief congressional reporter. Here's what he said to Mitch McConnell, who I assume most people know is married to the Secretary of Transportation, Elaine Chao, who was born in Taiwan. So here's what Raju asked of McConnell. You're married to an immigrant who's a naturalized U.S. citizen. If someone was to tell her she should go back to her country because of her criticism of federal policy, wouldn't you consider it a racist attack? McConnell essentially avoids the question, celebrates his wife's history, noting she came here, quote, at 8, legally not speaking a word of English. He added that Chao has realized the American dream. I think all of us think this is a process of renewal. It's gone on in this country for a very long time, and it's good for America. We ought to continue it. And Raju asked a follow-up question to his credit, and essentially McConnell never answers the question. But it is a brilliant question. And, you know, even a better question, a friend of ours who shall remain unnamed, texted me after a discussion we had yesterday with Art Kaplan about the racist language, and said if the criterion for going back to your country is criticizing the federal government, then Donald Trump should be going back to whatever country.
I mean,
country
he's the complainer in chief.
He allegedly
American
came from.
Cottage.
No one has criticized
and the founding framers. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, in other words,
another,
you know, it's like,
that's another good
right.
Point.
It's just, you know, if you complain about the country, look, the president, you know, obviously views the First Amendment through the lens of whether you support him or don't support him. He's clearly, and I say this, you know, something is unhinging before our eyes. And this strategy that he's playing, you know, does it help him? Does it hurt him politically? I don't really care. I mean, in other words, the politics is about this. There's a human being who is president of the United States who actually believes this. I do believe that's true. He has a rally tonight, and I anticipate, just given the pushback he's gotten on his statements, the paranoia that he has right now, the Mueller testimony coming up, the Epstein video coming out, this is going to be bonkers.
That was something. Did you see that this morning? It was really something.
Let's just say he likes touching the women. Donald Trump, my God, I'm not laughing.
No,
but that
and
is just
we're touching each other. So
yeah,
kind
that's
of,
true, too. But I mean, you know, this is I think it's important. And look, you know, Nancy Pelosi is also thinking all these guys have to go back to their districts. Some of them are going to be in districts that don't that have huge immigrant populations. Some of her moderate Democrats will probably be challenged. And she wants every Republican to have to be on the record about whether Donald Trump's tweets were racist. I think that's not, if you have a large minority or large immigrant population in your jurisdiction, I think that's I think you have to answer that. And I think it shows McConnell's twisting in the winds about how to answer about his wife shows how hard it is for even McConnell, who's, not known for his sort of ethical clarity, that even McConnell had challenges answering.
So, Juliet Kayyem, you have a great column in The Washington Post talking about the crisis at the border. And your claim is that it's only a crisis because the president isn't doing what he could. You are a former Assistant Secretary of the Homeland Security. So tell us why.
So after Pence left visiting the detention facilities on Friday, I just listened to what he was saying. And something seemed wrong about what he was saying. I mean, one, it's not perfect and people aren't being treated well. But he kept talking about a crisis at the border being the reason why these 300, 400 men were in a cell that reporters described as their inability to be able to lie down. One shower had just been delivered the day before. And it struck me that we've all been fooled by the Trump administration into sort of a geographic melding between challenges that we have at the border, right, which there are many causes for it. A lot of it, the Trump administration's policies, but there are multiple reasons for why we're seeing what we're seeing at the border, and the detention conditions within the United States of America. And if you just think, okay, if you have 400 people or however many people that you need to hold in the United States, what's going on here that we're detaining them that way? Because we don't have a supply chain problem in this country. So I just wanted to describe to people, you know, our ability in a country that has roads and Wi-Fi and electricity and water and food, that the solution to the detention condition problem as compared to the border problem is really one of logistics. And we know how to solve that. Yeah. And I just wanted to call Pence out for that sort of turn of phrase that he, you know, that sort of obfuscation of at the border and in the United States. And I think people, like, hopefully it was a little bit of a light bulb to people be like, yeah, this is ridiculous. You could have lots and lots of people at the border either scrambling to get in or in. Even if your numbers go up by 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, we know how to do this. Then you have a state like Texas, or you have a state like California, you have a state like Arizona, right, where you can surge resources in a heartbeat. We know how to do this. So I just described how to do it. And therefore, the answer is, why aren't they doing it? Well, one is because cruelty is the point, right, that they view cruelty as a deterrent. But the other is that they're really nincompoops. I mean, that their ability to effectuate the policies, forget whether you like the policy or not, is so bad. People don't know what they're doing. You have acting upon acting upon acting person, you know, some guy who ran, you know, Trump, Iowans for Trump, you know, his 22-year-old son is now an assistant secretary. I mean, I don't know. These people are not qualified. And I'll tell you, you know, if, you know, the standards for going into the Trump administration now are so insane that Monica Crowley, the deputy national security advisor, who got kicked out 3 months into the administration for plagiarism and for not disclosing certain contacts with foreign entities, who has spent the last 2 years getting lots of money from the Ukrainians, i.e. the Russians, is now back as an assistant secretary at the Department of Treasury. They just announced it today.
Wow, yeah. I did not
know
that.
So they come back, right? But because the standards are off.
You know who her, by the way, who her late brother-in-law was?
Alan Combs.
Alan Combs.
It used to be Sean Hannity and Combs.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned the
thing
that—
It was the liberal on Hannity and Combs.
That I've mentioned a few times. Is it you send in the National Guard?
Yeah, you do.
I mean, we do that. And
you get volunteer
when
resources.
When you don't have those Wi-Fi and internet electricity after hurricanes and tornadoes.
That's what I said.
And natural disasters
all
over
really
the United
States.
It's
really easy to do this when the winds aren't blowing and the earth isn't shaking.
But then you have to say they just passed this $4 billion-plus deal. So are they building new stuff now or what's happening?
I mean, my understanding is that they're having the military paint the wall, that is part of the agenda.
But the $4 billion they just passed, that's supposed to be for the border.
Right.
The conditions.
Well, I mean, we don't know. Right. For the conditions aspect of it, that's what makes me think that this is a, you know, this is probably 20% cruelty, 80%. They are so bad at their job. Like, why is a man being held in a detention facility for over 30 plus days that he's not processed, he's not bathed, he's not adequately fed, there's no proceedings going on? I don't even understand. Like, that's the easiest thing to solve.
So what's going
and
on?
And much
with the,
cheaper.
So we're talking with Juliette Kayyem, a former assistant at the former assistant. What were you assistant? What were you there over there?
The assistant secretary.
Thank you.
At DHS. That's okay.
DHS.
I've only been doing this with you for 4 years, but we love you.
It's okay. I'm making a lot of mistakes today, but I'm trying to up
that's okay.
My game.
I still can't fill my mouth. So how am I doing?
Half of the show. What's going on with the raids? We were supposed to have all these raids on Sunday. We didn't have many. Are they going to be rolled out more slowly?
They might be rolled out. I mean, the news is different. I mean, you know, obviously these are a different kind of raid because most of these families are under final deportation orders. So in some weird, you know, in some way of describing it, that these are sort of justified deportations. I don't like putting it that way, although there probably are citizens amongst these families that can't be deported. You know, it's very clear. I think it's a little, I was describing it the other day on air, like it's a little bit like the Syria announcement that Trump gets the headlines without the headache. So he gets to announce all this stuff is going on, terrify these communities. So you saw pictures, people were taking pictures in areas in Brooklyn and the Bronx, where there used to be hundreds of families out on a Sunday afternoon. Everyone was inside. So part of it is just the terror and the fear that you're going to get in these with these families who are going to live like this for forever, because presumably ICE is going to try to deport them. But we don't know what's going on. Trump, and part of my theory that something is so off now, Trump did say on air yesterday, or in his weird, I don't know when he spoke to the media, he did say that they did happen, but they were so smooth that none of us noticed. I mean, this is a president, you know, and I was like, okay, the invisible ICE agents, you know, that's like the new thing. So I think his staff is feeding him things. And there's a lot of subterfuge going on. My guess is that DHS and ICE said we don't have capacity. The fact that Trump announced when they were going to be put ICE agents at risk, put families at risk, put local law enforcement at risk, and so they simply told Trump what he wanted to hear.
But you know, I have to say, I was totally wrong about this, and when I say that, I'm saying it quickly because I want Marjorie to say again, yes, again. My thesis was that because Trump promised an executive order to put the citizenship question on the census and then back down at the last minute, that was, I think, on Friday, that his raids on Sunday were going to even be more ferocious than were originally planned. You say to yourself, even if his base, as it's called, is totally loyal, if immigration is the red meat that excites them most, is there not a point at which they say, this is the boy who cried wolf?
Yeah.
He was going to, trust
but
me, it'll be a
know.
Citizenship question. No, there isn't. There's absolutely going to be raids. They're going to be big-time raids. They're not raids. So while it may satisfy his long-term agenda to allow fear to hang over these communities forever, as you said a minute ago, I don't know how easily that's sellable to the base that...
Mark my words, though. Tonight, he will talk about raids as if they had happened. And that group will get galvanized.
And he's
going to
talk about how the so-called squad, or the anti-military, the communists, he just makes these things up. And people believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times have I heard that? When I first heard it, I thought, gee, what did Ayanna Pressley say about the military?
Well, but one thing, but that's his, I'm not defending him, believe me. However, his view about whether someone, for example, is a socialist, which is going to be his major rallying cry in the next X number of months.
Communist, or
a communist, even though he may not know what a communist is. No, I don't mean that. I mean, that is what it is. Or that they're anti-American. That's his opinion. I don't know if it's a legit opinion on his part or not. What Juliet's talking about is just factually,
yeah, it's just
totally.
Well, I think
but
you
made
that's
up.
What, no,
if the biggest crowds, the most, the best polling. All you know, this is a man who lives in a delusional state, and he has an entire apparatus feeding that delusion. And when he gets most upset is when he recognizes that the delusion is not true, right? That Mueller isn't going away, or that his polling isn't as high as he hopes, or whatever. So he then lashes out to the, I mean, you know, great for the squad. It is four freshmen representatives. They are not a movement. They are not, they are great. They are fantastic. They are wickedly smart. They are political in all the good meanings of the word. They are not what ails Trump. Right. But he has to target them because they are women of color. There's just no question about it. Right. There are other foreign born.
They have two problems. They're women and they're not white.
Right. And they're not white. Right.
Those
that
are
is exactly
for
right.
The president.
Period.
You know, by the way, I just want to say before you go, we started this discussion about this impeachment motion that will be before the House and what will happen with it. Nancy Pelosi is holding a press conference, I think, at 1 o'clock today.
Wow.
Obviously, it'll be asked as soon as she is asked answers that question about whether she's going to move the table. As Juliet suggested she might, we will let you know. Juliet, it's great to see you.
Great to see both of you.
Thank
I'll
you
see
very
you in
much,
2 weeks.
Juliet Kayyem. Okay.
Okay, bye.
All right,
bye.
See you later.
Ms. Mueller.
Juliet Kayyem joins us every week. She's an analyst for CNN, former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government.
Let me just say also, we've mentioned Mueller a few times today. We will bring it to you live.
Yep.
There are rumors it's going to start as early as 9 a.m. next Wednesday, the 24th, whatever time it starts, you will get gavel-to-gavel coverage live here.
Bring in the espresso machine right into the studio.
We are.
Juliet, thank you very much. Up next, Airbnb. Airbnb goes rural.
Maybe you just want to call it quits. I mean, for the day. I'm not suggesting permanently.
I'm having a tough day. No, I haven't been to speech lessons lately.
Why don't we try that all over again? What were you saying, please?
I'm just going to say that Corby Kummer is
coming up
to talk about food and other things next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. I don't know if I can do this as well as Marjorie, but I will try. Arby's. Okay, let's start this again. Arby's has a beef with plant-based meat alternatives, and they're retaliating with meat-based vegetables. They actually are. Joining us on the line to talk about this, our favorite story of the day, how a Michelin chef had a major meltdown
over cheddar
cheese and other headlines at the intersection of food policy and food culture. It's Corby Kummer. Corby is the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute. We've never even been invited. Senior editor at The Atlantic and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hello, Corby Kummer.
Well, hello there.
Well, Corby Kummer, I learned something that was very encouraging today, that the United States of America, through the government, supplies food trucks to distribute free lunch to kids in places like New York City where lots of kids are poor. That's the upside. I guess the
You left out the key during summer when there's no school.
Oh, I didn't say summer.
Didn't
okay,
say
I'm
yeah.
sorry. Right now. I didn't even know this.
Nor did I.
But apparently not that many kids are taking advantage of the program, even if they are so-called food insecure. What's going on?
It's a really interesting story in New Food Economy about the eligibility of so many students to get summer meals, but they're not taking it up. So why summer meals? Because whenever you study food insecurity, which is defined by families or people not being sure where their next meal is going to come from when they wake up in the morning, if they're going to have enough to eat that day, summer school lunch is a real absence and problem for families that rely on it. It's one of the reasons that a lot of districts that qualify for free lunch serve free breakfast too. And that's a big part of a child's nutrition. And it's what they need during the day. So quite a while ago, the USDA extended this to summer meals programs. Generally speaking, as the article says, about half the children residing in a certain area have to qualify for free or reduced price lunch. And then there are these, you know, fabulous food trucks, or what's more like it is occasional churches, occasional meal programs that are hard to get to. That's why there's low participation. So they think that one in seven kids who qualify for these across the country are taking up USDA on it. And obviously the Trump administration is going to do nothing to try to publicize it or encourage further participation.
So why don't local governments, who are directly responsible to low-income people in their communities, if the feds won't publicize it adequately, why don't cities, towns, and states publicize it adequately?
Well, A, that's a good question. B, I remember that when Mayor Menino was opening the summer camp on Long Island.
Harborview.
Well, which you might have visited. I haven't, but still flourishes. There was a lot of publicity then about the availability of summer lunch and how important it is to take care of kids during the summer and just don't let them be abandoned to the streets, essentially, in the summer. So I know that Boston was doing something about it. I bet they still are. But it's a question of how much funds does a municipality have available? And I don't even know if many districts are even aware that this summer feeding lunch option exists.
You know, we have Marty Walsh on Friday at the library. We're going to ask him about that. It's a very
and he has been
question.
He's been alerted in advance.
Well, you know, but well, in addition to which, he is very he's been very supportive of that program.
Camp.
By the Shaw Family Foundation.
Oh, yes.
Which is doing the quality of lunches.
Yeah, that was
schools.
A great piece by the Shaw Foundation that talked about what they've done is they pay for all these kitchens in individual schools in Boston so the food can be prepared there. But they showed in that documentary about how a lot of these kids in Boston schools are getting essentially frozen meals inside plastic containers. You couldn't even tell what they were.
And often and, throwing them right in the
garbage.
And not
eating them. And then they transfer it to this. They're hoping to get it through most of the Boston Public Schools, which would be great. But anyway.
Can I, you know, speaking of lunch, though, can I just change the subject?
Certainly.
I was trying to figure out what I'd eat today.
You ate my lunch.
Well, I ate part of your lunch.
You're not food insecure.
It wasn't enough. I'm far from food insecure. But I'm thinking of having, I wanted your opinion as a food critic. I was thinking of having a marrow today. I wasn't. Sure, and
yeah.
I brought a few marrots in, and I was
Is this a joke?
What? No, I'm going to eat them
serious?
For lunch.
Okay, this is from Arby's. They have an answer to plant-based meat. That's a headline mm-hmm. from the New York Times. And yeah. the answer is a meat-based carrot
it's called a marrot.
A marrot.
Yeah.
Now, I is this serious?
Yes.
It's not serious.
Yes,
here we are. It's a publicity stunt.
Serious.
Arby's is saying, we serve a lot of meat. We like a lot of meat.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think our customers want these newfangled, ridiculous, hippie, vegan-type substitutes for
right,
meat.
Right, we want marrots.
What we want to do is call attention to our Trump-style red meat serving.
Trump-style.
We only care about meat, and we're turning our back on impossible and beyond meat. And all these ridiculous namby-pamby, yuppie, foodie things. So they're inventing these things that they are meat substitutes for carrots.
Right, exactly. I mean, and by
the way, marrot.
It is a marrot, and they are going to be served. It's a piece
yeah.
of a chicken.
It's a meat vegetable. Turkey breast in cheese
cut in the shape of a carrot.
And coated in a carrot marinade.
Exactly.
It's just for publicity,
why
and here we are talking about it.
No, actually,
and
I'm
here
eating
the Times
it.
Was devoting 8 pages of a printed-out story
Look,
to this ridiculous.
But wait a second. There's no greater trumpeter of the Beyond, whatever the hell it's called, and Impossible. What are those two companies called, please?
Beyond Meat and Impossible.
Right.
Foods.
No greater trumpeter of them than you. But
sure.
when you read this story, with the exception of Burger King and Little Caesars, I don't even know where Little Caesars is, virtually every fast food chain has said no to these meat alternatives. And I mean, there is one that is at least open-minded. Which is McDonald's, which obviously would be huge.
But also Burger King.
I said Burger King is already doing it, and Little Caesars. So it isn't like it's taking over the fast food market,
also White
right?
Castle, our favorite
is
White
that true?
Castle. Yeah. They've been taking Beyond Meat for a while, and Burger King has Impossible. What this shows is that companies are cowardly. They want to see that it's actually catching on before they invest money. And as McDonald's says, our grill space is extremely valuable. And before we're willing to cede any of that real estate to these substitutes, we're going to make sure the market at our competitors, they can go out on a limb and they can lose money. We're not going to. It's a real wait-and-see approach. But Arby's has taken it a step farther to get itself the publicity we are giving.
Yep, we fell right into that trap. By the way, Lucia just emailed to tell us that Framingham the library there offers free lunch 3 days a week during the summer.
Really?
Yeah, so apparently this is going on in a lot of places. We just
it's
were unaware
of it. It's also
part
of the revitalization of libraries across the country.
Could
that
you do me a favor? Could
what?
You, while I'm talking to Corby, could you email her back and ask if they include marrots in that? You know, by the way, since you mentioned White Castle, I'm telling you a story I've never told you before, Corby. There used to be a White Castle in Central Square. Do you remember the White Castle?
I do not.
Okay, it was two hamburgers for 99 cents when I moved there. And I got in a little argument with the guy who was at the cash register.
Is that a euphemism, little argument?
Yes, it is. A little argument with the guy because I was being treated disrespectfully. And
the cardinal sin.
And we went back and forth. One of our coworkers said, yeah, 2 for $0.99, but those burgers are the size of a dime. They were
That's
small.
Right.
But
That's
they
right.
were. However, let me finish my story because it's a really, really
okay,
important
we're
one.
We're all waiting.
Thank you. It is not about merits. But so essentially, I was treated disrespectfully. So I had a word or two with the guy who was the cashier there. And
yeah.
I gave him
Very
$1
civilized.
For my two hamburgers. And I was I didn't wait for the penny because, you know, screw him. I'm getting out of here. And I get in my car and I'm furious, but I'm also hungry. So I unwrap one of the hamburgers and I take a bite out of it. He put my penny change inside the hamburger. And
that was really inventive.
Wait a second. What's so funny? I practically broke like three teeth.
What qualifies as being disrespectful to you, Jim? I'm just curious.
I went up to him. I said, do you know who I am? And he didn't. Well, I mean, does it get any more disrespectful than that?
Exactly.
But you know what?
He was a little jerk. I don't know what he said. I don't remember. It was 20 years ago. Okay. But I did put a penny in my burger.
That's stuck in your memory and apparently, your craw. So 2 for 99 cents illustrates that White Castle claims to have invented the slider, which is a way of saying we found a way of fobbing off a tiny, tiny bit of meat for a very little bit of money. But they were indeed, and I think they still are famous for their sliders that are cheap.
I didn't know that.
So here is another 8 or 10 page story from the New York Times. This one is about bottle bills, which have been not done very well with voters. I guess only one state since 87, that's Hawaii, has passed a bottle bill. But this seemed to indicate, and I was a little confused, to tell the truth, Corby, but the industry now, as in Coca-Cola, et cetera, are not fighting bottle bills
please.
Anymore?
Oh, please.
Of course they're fighting bottle bills.
Okay, they are. So I misunderstood it completely. What is going on then?
What you did is, you know, again with the propaganda. So what is the propaganda now? The underlying fact is soda companies hate bottle bills because it depresses sales and they lose money.
Okay.
Bottle bills are effective for recycling because more people go back and give their bottles to get back the 2 cents or the 5 cents or whatever the deposit is. So they really work, but they're not good for business. Because they're not good for business, the reason is you're saying innocently, well, they haven't done well since the mid-late 80s. They haven't done well because there have been these massive industry-funded campaigns against them. And now the reason you think that Coca-Cola is opening the door to them is because they indeed say they are opening the door to supporting bottle bills as long as they include other kinds of food containers like yogurt, which right now are exempted. And they say if we're not unfairly and exclusively targeted, we believe in recycling just as much as the next guy. There was an example in this New York Times piece about Atlanta, the home place, homeland of Coca-Cola, donating $4 million to the city for a scavenger program in which they would pay people to go and scavenge in various rubbish bins and find bottles and return them. So that was their way of saying, as long as it's not mandated across the city that everybody is paying 2 to 3 cents extra, which they can get, we'll support it. And the company and Atlanta caved in. And they said, okay, no bottle bill because how nice that we have this one-time $4 million grant from impoverished Coca-Cola.
Yeah, I have two things that I'd like to add about this. First of all, does the story say there are only 10 states that actually mandate recycling?
I was very surprised by that because I thought it was much more.
So did
I. I thought it was much more,
And don't
too.
You remember in Massachusetts, MassPurg was the group behind this, and they were always huge amounts of money spent. But I have one question on the merits and then one political thing. On the merits, assuming that the vast majority of people agree that recycling and the deposit is a good idea. I forgot the beverage companies. Is there any reason why carbonated drinks should be included and non-carbonated containers should not be? On the merits, not politics. Is
Absolutely
there?
Not.
Okay. And in terms of the politics, can I tell you, and by the way, I understand why you reacted like you did, Marjorie, because, you know, to reading the story.
I read
you know
it
what
too
this
fast.
Drives? This is like when you turn on television or the radio and you hear one of those vaping companies saying, oh, please, all you people under 21, remember that it's illegal to do this. We discourage the use and it's illegal. It's basically an advertisement for people under 21 to go do that which they pretend like they don't want you to do.
Which is the biggest incentive to say it's forbidden.
Exactly. It is so totally phony.
You know,
it's insane.
Let me ask you one other question, Corby. What about all the coffee cups everybody drinks, whether they're from Dunkin' Donuts, whether they're from Starbucks, or wherever you go to get your coffee? Some of them are recyclable. Many of them are not, right?
Yeah, but they're hugely problematic and guilt-inducing because they are lined with a plastic that evidently prevents them. And if you've gotten the unlined ones and you've had the hot coffee spill through the bottom, you know why they're lined with plastic. But evidently that plastic makes them very hard to recycle. And I think we talked about last year England mandating the redesign of coffee cups so that they're truly recyclable. And I guiltily, knowing they're not really recyclable, always throw them into the recycle bin. But they're not. And Dunkin' and Starbucks have said they're doing something about this.
Did I ever tell you, too, that I got in a fight with the cashier at 7-Eleven and I was drinking my seltzer, and there was a penny
you know,
at the
this
bottom
is a pattern,
of the.
Jim.
Did I ever tell you that? There's
many stories like this, yeah. Corby. We just don't have all day to talk about Jim's altercations with people, clerks, salespeople. You're always nice to the waiter and waitresses, though.
We call them waitresses.
I have to bring up one more aspect of this story, which is so ironic and infuriatingly helps the bottle companies, which is in Tennessee where this came up.
Oh, gosh.
There's this program to use inmates to go by the roadsides and collect bottles to get money for them and put them in the recycle bill and their cleanup crews. And if there was actually a statewide bottle bill, that money for the inmates would go away. And so the state wants this money that they're getting from the Jeez. Companies to go and use this kind of paid slave labor. And they don't want to lose it. So you know, what I say to Coca-Cola is, it's great that you're opening the door and saying you're all for recycling. Let's see you actually put money behind a revised bill that includes food containers.
We're talking to Corby Comer.
So Airbnb, very popular. Lots of people use it. Apparently now small farmers, and one of them is featured from up in Maine on Vox, who is doing Airbnb to help mom stay at home with the kids and have the people that want to rent come up for a rural vacation with the meat so good a vegetarian would eat it, as they advertise.
I think it's brilliant.
It is. I think it is brilliant. They built a cool little house. What do you think?
I think that it's Airbnb to us today.
I know. I did say
but,
that.
But, you know, I think they might change their branding because it's very good.
I think so,
what
too.
What this is playing off the Italian and other ideas, but especially developed in Italy because it was enshrined by the state in 1985. Agriturismo, or agriturismo, if you're being pretentious like me, which is farm visits and farm tourism. Once the state enacted it, there are actually like state road signs to these farms that have in paying guests and have in visitors. And it's like one step removed from WOOF, the World Organic Something Foundation, where students go off and work for 2 to 3 months on an organic farm, which is great. But this way, it's just for 2 or 3 days when you can visit a farm, help or not help with the farm chores, get to see piglets being born, packed off for slaughter, and the other charming scenes of a farm. And Airbnb has, you know, taken up. They saw that this was a market. They're going into it. Airbnb for a while was doing, and they still do, these added experiences. I went to a coffee tasting in London of a guy who roasts his own coffee and makes money through Airbnb and gets the bookings for tourists who happen to be staying at Airbnbs and do this. This is extending this whole experience idea. It's very clever. Here we are talking about it. It's good publicity. But nobody else has been taking up the cause of farm visits as tourism, and they're doing it. And according to the statistics they gave Vox, almost 1 million guests from February 2018 to 19 stayed at a farm they found on Airbnb, and hosts with farm listings earned more than $81 million. And they quoted somebody in Maine as saying, the very pragmatic thing is, farms always have to have additional sources of income. Usually one spouse works for a company or the state or local government to get health insurance. You cannot survive just as a small farmer. This is a way of supplementing the income without having to go off-site. So you can keep doing your work. Maybe somebody will come help with the chores. But it's a small price to pay in labor to get some additional income right on your farm.
Did I ever tell you, Corby, about the time I got in a fight with a small farmer? And
you were buying eggs at a farm stand, right?
I was being treated really disrespectful. You know what?
You found they were all broken when you got home.
It's being treated really disrespectfully.
Well, rushed in our egg crate.
Well, this is a great story, and I love the creativity. It masked the underlying issue. I mean, we talked about Farm Aid yesterday, which is run by a friend of both yours and mine, which does incredible work for small farmers around the country. But the problem is, small farmers should be more supported so they can make a living, so they're not forced to do something like this. But if they have to
buy the government subsidies that go to huge farms.
That is a brilliant point. Thank you very much. We're talking to Corby Comer, our food guy.
I had no idea the levels of stress in the high-end restaurant business, but this guy from La Maison des Bois, this French restaurant, obviously. Kind of completely lost it when he was accused of using cheddar cheese in one of his dishes he said he's been depressed for 6 months.
Well, because he lost a star.
He lost a star from the Michelin Guide. Mm-hmm. And apparently this is not that unusual for people. Well, we talked to you about this before.
Don't you remember the guy that said, I don't want to be rated anymore? We talked to Corby about that guy.
Didn't some guy commit suicide? And then Gordon Ramsay.
That's a couple of years ago.
When he was stripped of a Michelin star at his New York restaurant, he compared the experience to losing a girlfriend. Or losing...
What could be worse, Gordon Ramsay?
Yeah, he probably has a lot of girlfriends, I bet. But anyway, they're beside themselves over this. And I guess it's a wonderful restaurant.
It's a very good restaurant. The guy's named Mark Veyrat, V-E-Y-R-A-T, and he's known for his great ways with vegetables and his great experience of completely local produce. And what he is claiming is that the Michelin Guide said that they put cheddar in their cheese souffle instead of their reblochon, beaufort, and tum.
Exactly.
But, you know, the end of the story, The Guardian, which ran this story with the cheddar headline, waits till the very end to say, in fact, Michelin never said anything about cheddar.
Ooh.
So, where did Mark Veyrat get this? Indeed, he is a sore loser. He lost a star. But some of his accusations bear looking into. He's saying that Michelin inspectors don't know what they're doing. They don't necessarily come. I think that they do. I think that Michelin could produce the receipts, but apparently, even though he's demanding it, they're not. But I read a sort of disturbing story in the past year that there are a lot of additions, especially in Southeast Asia, Singapore, even ones in China, that are essentially pay for play. So a local company will say, we want to increase tourism to our area, so we're going to pay Michelin to come in, send its evaluators, and they will produce a sponsored guide. But it's a funny brand dilution of Michelin. So he's saying they're just commercially driven. Well, they are commercially driven. And he says Michelin, they're basically amateurs. They couldn't cook a decent dish. This is what a lot of sore losers and chefs say when they are denied an award that is not given by their fellow chefs. It's a frequent complaint, including about the James Beard Awards, which are not decided by chefs. They're decided by journalists, writers, and other kinds of experts. So they say we only want to be evaluated by their peers. What happens when there's peer evaluation is people vote for their friends, and it's an old boys' club, usually old boys, and it doesn't work so well.
We're speaking to James Beard Award winner, I should say, Corby Kummer. We are. Now, Corby, can we stay on this first? I know we've had this discussion with you before, but I can't remember what the answer was. Michelin at the top is 3 stars or 4 stars? I forget.
Three.
Are there any three? We had this. Are there any 3-star restaurants in New England or no?
No, I think there might have been one. Oh, no, that was a Relais and Chateau, highest rating in southeast Maine. No, there are no 3-star restaurants here. And the restaurateur, Patrick O'Connell at the Inn at Little Washington, was beside himself with joy when he got one because he'd been working forever for it. But what does working forever for a 3-star restaurant mean? You will spend a fortune on linen cleaning, on silverware polishing, on all of these trappings that have nothing to do with food, everything to do with hugely high prices, inflated, pompous service, and I think a very unpleasant experience. So my foodie friends have generally avoided 3-star restaurants like the plague for decades because you go for a very pretentious experience. It's not focused on the food. And you generally hone in on the 1- and 2-star restaurants, which probably have much better value ratio.
What's the best 3-star Michelin restaurant you've ever eaten in?
You know, it was my first. And
which
I think
where?
That's what everybody will say. It was a restaurant in Paris, and the ceiling retracted to let in the moon. Ooh. And it was a name like La Durée, but it wasn't La Durée. And, you know, it was beautiful, and it was incredibly elegant, and I'd always dreamed of it. And that was it. You know, one was enough, and I was in... I wasn't even 20, but that's all I ever needed to do for life. 3-star restaurants are just about pomp and pretension.
Do you know why I said Airbnb?
Well, no,
well,
we don't, Margaret.
Stephen just emailed to say that's because Mercury is in retrograde.
Retrograde? Marriage is what brings us together.
Well, according to Stephen, Mercury retrograde brings communication and technological breakdowns, nervous anxiety, travel delays, and lost items. Thank you.
We all have a lot to look forward to today.
Thank you.
Wait a second. Can I a moment of seriousness here? It's in retrograde right now? White now it is or not?
White now.
White now. That's amazing.
Retrograde.
Well, okay. Marjorie, the good news for you is the show's over in an hour and 2 minutes and we can start all over again. Corby, it's great to talk to you as always. Thank you, Corby.
Thank you, Corby Cummer. Corby joins us every week. He's the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute.
Probably going to get fired today.
A senior editor at The Atlantic and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. Thank you, Corby.
Yes.
Up next, MIT economist John Gruber is here to talk about the cost. The rent may be too damn high, but is controlling the rent the answer?
You know what he's going to do? He's going to tell us what's wrong with rent control. Yes, John Gruber's up next.
He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And I think we can all agree with Jimmy McMillan that the rent is too damn high, but not so much on how to bring it down.
Love to.
Is rent control the answer, or could it end up hurting city newcomers and work to deepen inequality in the long run? Here with us in Studio 3 to talk through the costs of rent control and the benefits, I hope, is Jonathan Gruber. John is the Ford Professor of Economics at MIT. He was instrumental in creating both the Massachusetts Healthcare Reform and the Affordable Care Act, and his latest book is called Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth and the American Dream. John Gruber, nice to see you.
Great to be back.
Nice to see you too, Jonathan Gruber. So before we talk about the pros and cons of rent control, just explain to people what it is.
So rent control is basically the idea that for some subset of renters, for example, people in houses that were built before some date, their rent cannot increase more than a certain amount per year. So in other words, it's saying instead of letting the market determine what your rent will be, we are going to lock in rents at some level, and we're going to say we're going to regulatorily allow how much they can increase. So it's really that pretty straightforward. It's essentially letting the regulators set the price of what the rent is rather than letting the market set the price.
And we should say, by the way, for those who are newcomers to town, or at least newcomers comparatively speaking, in 1994, this ballot question was actually sponsored by a neighbor of mine, unfortunately, I would argue. And by a narrow 51-49 margin, rent control was repealed statewide. But the most significant part of that, for those who are not familiar with it, is the three communities that had rent control, including Cambridge, all voted to keep rent control. And the 348 cities and towns that did not have rent control voted to repeal it, but it was a statewide ballot question, and as a result, statewide rent control was banned 25 years ago.
So the more I've read about this in anticipation of talking with you today, John, the more discouraged I get about rent control, but maybe I'm wrong. What are the pros and cons?
Well, the pros of rent control are that basically let's be in the Boston context. We have a city where it's become explosively unaffordable to live here, where people who have been here for many decades are suddenly being forced out, and they're forced out of their houses, they're forced out of the neighborhood. So my daughter's girlfriend is a third-generation Southie, and she is, their family and people she knows, upset that Southie's getting gentrified, and the friends that they have to leave, and that neighborhood breaks up, and you can't preserve the neighborhoods. The cons are numerous, and this is why there isn't an economist alive there aren't many economists who like rent control. The cons are numerous. The first con is that it's not redistributing necessarily the right people. The famous story here, of course, is one of the most famous conservative philosophers is a guy named Nozick, a professor at Harvard, who was famous for talking about free markets, and he lived in a rent-controlled apartment, apparently. So it doesn't necessarily get money to poor people. It gets money to lucky people who happen to live in the rent-controlled apartments when the law was passed. That's problem one. Problem two is that landlords facing rent control have no incentive to maintain their apartments and keep them nice because essentially they're getting underpaid for those apartments anyway. They're going to rent them no matter what they do, so they might as well let them get run down. That's a problem for the apartment itself. It's also a problem for the neighborhood. Indeed, a study by my colleagues at MIT, David Auder and Parag Patak, found that when rent control ended in Cambridge, neighborhood values of the non-rent-controlled apartments went through the roof. Not just the rent-controlled apartments, but the non-rent-controlled apartments, because presumably because suddenly there was a nicer neighborhood. And then finally, the other big disadvantage that I think is really interesting, and this recent research by a woman named Rebecca Diamond at Stanford, showing that what happened in San Francisco when they put in rent control was, on the one hand, a bunch of people in the apartments that got rent control were better off. They moved less. They got to stay in their apartments. On the other hand, what they found was whenever an apartment got – when the renters left, it got quickly converted to an expensive condo. Rather than staying on the rental market, it got pulled off the rental market. And ironically, over the long run, it increased the gentrification of San Francisco.
Yeah.
Because a bunch of apartments that were rental apartments got taken off the rental market because the landlords didn't want them to be subject to these laws and turned into condos that were sold to rich yuppies. So it's sort of along every dimension you look at it, it kind of backfires.
Okay, so can we go down the list here so I don't have a stroke? Is that okay,
yeah,
John Gruber? Okay, now, Marjorie and I, did we know? No, we didn't know each other when this thing passed. And what Marjorie would do whenever we discuss rent control is she would say, it's your friends, Jim Browdy, and people like you who led to the demise of rent control because it was so arbitrary is not the word to use, so strict in terms of it's how it penalized landlords. I'm putting words in your mouth, but I don't think you'll disagree mm-hmm. with me. In some cases, owners couldn't even live in their own property. You mentioned the guy at Harvard. I used to pass a sign on a house on River Street when rent control existed, where it listed every single wealthier person who lived in a rent control apartment, including, by the way, the head of GBH 35 or 40 years ago.
Weren't you in a rent control apartment?
No, in New York City, I was in a lot of rent control apartments.
But lawyers. We want to put more lawyers.
Yeah, I was making $14,000 in legal services, Marjorie. Okay, so
you're a lawyer, Jim.
And my response to Marjorie, after having been viciously attacked by her, John Gruber, was to say,
I can see the scars, by the way.
I had just moved there here at the time, and I, in fact, went to the leaders of the pro rent control forces and said the following: if you don't fix, in quotes, rent control, someday you're going to lose it. So let's start with your first point. Is wealthy people living there? The answer is means test rent control. If you create a new law, unlike New York State, which I think just Andrew Cuomo signed a bill that allowed people making more than 200 grand to go in a rent controlled or rent stabilized apartment, means test it so that wealthy people can't take advantage of something that at least is intended by people of goodwill to go to people with moderate means. Is that not a solution to the first problem?
That would absolutely help with the first problem. It would raise interesting issues like, do you means test on entry and then continually as they're there? So the law student who becomes the lawyer, do they get kicked out once they become the lawyer? What political problems? I mean, we're getting away from politics.
That's an important question.
But yes, as long in theory, avoiding the politics, that could absolutely help with the first problem.
And you could draft something that would accommodate
absolutely.
That? Okay, fine.
Absolutely.
Let's go to the second thing, the incentive kind of thing. One thing where I am totally in agreement with you
actually,
is the neighbor. I'm sorry.
Let me just go back to the first thing.
Sure.
There's one other wrinkle which is tricky, which is when you talk about rich, do you mean asset rich or income rich? So, for example, let's go to Southie. So basically, you have people there who are still not income rich, but are now sitting on these
property rich
on these
and
properties
cash poor, right.
that are very rich. So I think in theory it's solvable. I just want to say in practice it's not simple.
Well, you know, some people thought that nobody could ever draft the Affordable Care Act and Romney Care, and somebody I know helped draft both. Is that not? Oh, it was you actually? Second thing about the place in your second point about there's almost a disincentive for landlords to keep these properties up because they don't make as much money on it. You also added there, and this is totally true, I live on Immon Street in Cambridge. The Immon Street I live on 25, 30 years after I moved there, pre and post rent control is dramatically different. There's no question. My property value has gone up because rent control is repealed. I'm assuming the family down the block who led the fight to repeal rent control has seen their properties value. The bad news is it is a totally gentrified community.
But here's the argument, though, that these economists are making, that the same thing happens with rent control. Because what you do is it's very good, as you say, for the people, John, that get the rent control apartments.
But it's really bad for other low-income people who can't get in to the rent control apartments.
Can we stay on the incentive not to keep it up? Right. The answer is that there's got to be enforcement. But if it turns out a rent control or rent stabilized landlord says, I'm only making $10 a month on this apartment, I'm making $500 a month on my non-rent controlled apartment down the block. If they allow a rental property to deteriorate, and I was a tenant lawyer, this is what I used to do for a living, is deal with these kinds of things. The answer is city inspectors have to ensure they comply with the law. Is that not? I mean, they may not be as luxurious as a non-rent controlled apartment. What?
Where are the
city inspectors doing a good job? There's not enough inspectors. We have all these horrible stories all the time about Austin and Brighton where they've stuffed 17
students. I agree, it's a problem.
No, but Jim, unlike the first one where you're right, a law could be written with various – you have to deal with various things. Law could be written. This one, it's too arbitrary to regulate what proper upkeep means. I mean, you're right. You could say if there's rats, you're not doing a good job. But there's a large room between rats and proper upkeep.
I agree with that.
And I think it's just – that is going to be too hard regulatorily to make it really happen. On the first point, I think you're right in theory and could work in practice. On the second point, you're right in theory. I just don't see how it works in practice.
Well, let me ask is some of the things.
We're talking to John Gruber, by the way, about rent control as a. And by the way, for those who are regular listeners to our show, we've talked to Marty Walsh about this. We've talked to virtually everybody who cares about the unaffordability of housing.
Right.
And there's nobody in leadership, at least, who is rushing to file a reinstitution of rent control.
No, there
bill.
Isn't. But Marty Walsh did testify for the legislature proposing a bill that would say you can only have no fault. You can't be thrown out of your apartment in Boston over age 75 unless for fault. And you have to can't raise the rent for more than 5% if you are doing something for old people.
That comes back to Jim's first point about doing a more targeted, means tested approach, and that certainly would be a step in the right direction. But
how about vouchers? Somebody people talk about vouchers.
Well, I mean, in some sense, here's the really interesting point, which is that we have a set of people we care about, which is low income people who cannot afford to stay in their communities.
Correct.
Rent control is just too blunt an instrument to get at those people. Now, Jim, you'd like to create a sharper instrument within rent control.
Exactly.
But I think we ought to be thinking about recognizing the problem and thinking about what are the other things we can do to deal with this. So, for example...
Well, wait. Before we get to other alternative solutions, what was your third point about...
My third point was this really crazy point, which I think no one realized this article really showed in San Francisco, which is that you were talking about how getting rid of rent control caused gentrification. But the point is, this argument, this article, which is very compelling, says in San Francisco, rent control caused gentrification.
Exactly.
Because what happened was you had this set of apartments that were being rented. Some got rent controlled. As soon as those rent controlled apartments turned over, the owner said, I'm pulling this out of the rental market because someone could move in tomorrow and stick me with a low rent forever. I'm turning into a high-end condo. It restricted the supply of rental. Of rental property.
For low-income people.
For everybody. There's just not enough places to rent in San Francisco and basically converted San Francisco from a rental community to an owner community.
But you know that there are condo conversion bills in lots of parts of the country which limit a landlord's right to make those kinds of conversions if purely to escape rent regulation.
But Jim, here's my point is you are layering regulation on regulation
and
inspect on
regulation.
Yes,
that is correct.
So that's why I think that your goal is admirable, and we've got a huge problem of affordability of housing in the city, especially for low-income people. But I think we need to think about other – I think what the economic evidence is saying is rent control would be like last on your list of ways
to get what would be – I interrupted you before when you were going to tell us what is first, second, or third on your list, John Gruber. What would be atop your list of how to make housing more affordable without waiting another generation to get there.
So basically, once again, we're trying to put politics aside for a minute.
Yeah, let's.
Number one is looser zoning regulations. We need to basically have more high-rise buildings, more buildings. We need more space. Supply. The answer is we need more supply of rental housing. And when you build rental housing with affordability restrictions, when they build new rental housing in Massachusetts, in Boston, there are affordability covenants. You've got to make 10%, 20%, 30% of the apartments affordable housing, okay?
Or pay into some linkage fund, right?
Something like that. Yeah. We need tons more supply. There is so much room in this city for more building.
There is?
But yes. What's getting in the way is zoning regulations, which say can't be above a
Where's
certain
height.
Where's
the room for more building?
There's room in Jim's neighborhood. Right now, I'm sure Jim could point to 10 or 20 buildings that could easily be 3 or 4 times higher and that basically could, there could be more supply. Everywhere, everywhere we look, there could be more supply. But basically, if you look at, now once again, ultimately we have traffic bottlenecks, we have public transportation bottlenecks, so there are limits. But the first thing is there are massive increases of supply that are possible.
But we have to give, incentive to developers. Because just like you talked about in San Francisco, if there's an incentive to convert after the fact, well, there's an incentive not to build affordable when you can build these luxury condos bought by some investor from, you know, Asia or something, or Qatar or whatever the hell it is.
There are plenty of places around where developers are chomping at the bit to build and would be happy, you know, not if you said it has to be 50% affordable housing, but if you said it has to be X percent affordable housing, I don't know if it's 10 or 20 or 30, that's a tax they're willing to pay to be able to build the high-end apartments that go with it. So I think increasing supply is number one. Number two is improving public transportation and increasing the ability of individuals to live not in the urban core, but to get to the jobs in the urban core.
The only reason I'm laughing because two of our four or five colleagues on the radio, when they got to work this morning, talked about how their normal, 15, 20 minute ride to work took a mere hour.
Right.
So, I mean, and this by the way, we have guests who are late for our show on a regular basis because they can't get to the show.
Absolutely.
On time. I mean, the transportation thing is a nightmare.
So number two is transportation. Number three, and this
is you can't gloss over that. I mean, we are in a city where everybody acknowledges we have a transportation problem, but it's not being fixed. I mean,
and this is where the superficial appeal of rent control comes. The other ideas I'm laying out here come. Let's take rent control versus transportation. Transportation, you've got to raise tax money to do it. Rent control, it's a hidden tax. It's a hidden tax that deteriorates property values and gentrifies cities, but at least it's hidden.
Well, you know,
so
I would argue
where you're going to get the money.
The one place I'd agree with you, because I'm still pro rent control, but that we'll continue that discussion another day. The reason why transportation may be a better focus, because that the constituency is not just low-income people or moderate-income people who want affordable housing. It's wealthy people and business leaders who, to do well in what they're doing, need a transportation system. Okay. So it sort of unites all advocates, is what I'm saying.
But, Jim, so here's my last attempt to get you to I found you, you know, intellectually willing to learn and be open on things.
No, I'm actually not.
So let me try.
Not at all, but go ahead anyway.
let me try one more idea. That's actually an idea due to Rebecca Diamond, who wrote this interesting article on San Francisco. What do we care? What are we upset about? We're not upset. So let's take someone in Southie. We're not necessarily upset that they have to move from one apartment in Southie to another. We're upset they have to leave Southie. They have to leave this neighborhood. What if we had vouchers, which basically said for people living in the community, we will send you money as a function of what happens to property values in the community. So if the community gets more expensive, then we'll send you a check to offset the overall rise in rents in the neighborhood. If you want to use that check to stay in the neighborhood, God bless you. If you want to use that check and say, this is my money, it's going to get me a new start somewhere else, you can do that too. So we're redistributing, and it's a means-tested check. So we're redistributing to the people who we want to help, which is the people, low-income people being displaced to neighborhoods. But we're not redistributing in a bad way, which is saying the only way we're going to help you is by forcing you to stay in this apartment. We're redistributing by saying, look, you're getting hurt because prices are going up. Let's tax some of those increased prices. Let's take the money and give it to the losers. But let's not do it in a way which distorts the housing supplies. Do it in a way which gives them money and lets them choose what to do with it.
You know, we're talking with Jonathan Gruber from MIT about rent control. One of these stories talked about...
This is his last appearance, so I hope he does well.
One of these stories talked about building different sized apartments too, and this is trying to happen, these teeny tiny apartments.
Micro apartments. We just talked about this a month or so ago. For younger people, millennials,
for younger people,
and
or,
seniors.
Exactly. That sounds like a fascinating avenue.
Well, as I said, answer number one is always supply, 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 and that could take many forms. Sometimes what gets in the way of those tiny apartments is zoning regulations. Let's loosen the regulations such that we can maximize the supply. There are natural limits, which are roads, and, you know, there are natural limits to You know, you can't, everything can't be 100 stories because you just can't move. If you ever been to Manhattan lately, you'll see what happens there. But basically, increasing supply is number one. But I want to come back to Jim, on working this, because you're being surprisingly intellectually inflexible compared to my usual experience.
That's right, Jim. You're intellectually inflexible.
Why not? Instead of your idea of rent
control,
mandate
everything.
Instead of your idea of rent control,
yes.
If what you want is you want to help low-income people afford to stay in this area,
of course, we have the same.
Why do it with an inefficient regulation? Why not do it with saying, with increased supply where there's affordability restrictions and where we take some of our property tax revenues and use that to give money to low-income people living in Boston?
Well, I'll tell you, I think the answer, since I'm, what am I, intellectually honest? And
inflexible.
What am I?
You're intellectually flexible.
Flexible, thank you. Is I've heard politicians, now I'm going to sound like Marjorie Egan on education. I've heard politicians everywhere I go talk about increasing the supply, which obviously makes huge sense. But the supply is never increased enough to accommodate the need. Is that not a fair
that's
statement?
That's absolutely right. That's
okay,
why I can't do it alone.
So that's why the Blunt instrument, as you would call it, has a little bit more appeal to me. But can I say, when you mentioned zoning, I feel we have to, since I was criticizing the governor fairly regularly on the transportation thing, didn't Governor Baker file a bill to change the zoning rules, I think recently, to reduce from super majorities to actual majorities for zoning boards and cities, you know, governing
yes.
bodies to allow for affordable housing. Arjun is confirming it. Thank
yes.
you, Arjun.
Yeah, no, that's right. Look, I totally agree with you, Jim. We've been saying this, and that's part of the motivation for my book, Jumpstarting America, is that we
can't... By the way, the fact that you took 18 minutes to mention the title of your book is embarrassing.
We're going to mention it again before it is.
So one of the arguments in our book is that we can't just keep shoving these jobs in Boston and San Francisco. We need to spread them around the country because ultimately... We're not going to change the zoning rules.
Did you see the piece in the Globe, by the way? We talked to Shirley Leung about this earlier today, about how they're talking about satellite. I thought of you. Yeah. Satellite cities, because Boston is getting just front. It's essentially your idea.
We need to jumpstart these other communities so they can compete. If we even look at Western Massachusetts, and once again, with improved public transportation, we can link these communities. We need to, you know, ultimately in the long run, Marjorie, you said something that doesn't help in the long run, but in the long run, the answer is to recognize we need to have technology hubs that are outside of the six coasts and the cities that are sucking up all the jobs.
Yeah, and we're one of those cities. We're up there with San Francisco and
right.
New York City. And so I guess New York City, we get to go in a second, but New York City is going to be sorry they did this legislation, you think, John Gruber?
Oh, absolutely. I think in the long run, it's not the answer. And I want to keep coming back on this topic until I convince Jim.
We will do. And by the way, I would love to continue right now, but unfortunately, since I am intellectually inflexible, there's really no point to... I mean, is that not obvious? We've established that.
I would just like to point out, you're a lawyer, right?
Sort of.
And a talk show host, whatever we are.
Well, that I sort of am.
He's an economist.
I know.
At MIT,
he's a fairly celebrated economist.
Who's studied
too.
These issues, Jim. You know what I'm saying? Maybe.
But
it's
summer,
possible.
And maybe the heat has had some impact on
more
his thinking.
About it
I don't know.
Than you do? Is that possible?
No, that is clearly not. John, it's great to see
okay.
you. Thanks
for
so
having
much.
Me.
You really
Jonathan Gruber. Is not only an economist at MIT, he's the Ford Professor of Economics, instrumental in creating both the Massachusetts healthcare reform and the Affordable Care Act. And he's written a book called Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth and the American Dream. Jonathan Gruber, thank you very much for coming in. Up next, the hazards of multitasking. Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us to talk about that next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie. And before we move ahead, we promised you we'd give you an update on what Nancy Pelosi had to say about this impeachment resolution that Congressman Al Green from Texas was going to have on the floor this afternoon. She basically, at her press conference, which is going on as we speak, when asked the question, said she had great respect for Mr. Green, a prayerful person, and she had earlier talked about Mueller and how they're looking forward to the testimony. But the key takeaway is when the reporter asked the follow-up question, what are you going to do? Are you going to move the table this impeachment resolution? That would mean it would be sent to committee. It wouldn't be acted on today. She said, I don't know what we will do, but we will deal with it on the floor. So the long answer to what we promise you is she's non-committal. But I think the conventional wisdom is there will not be a vote on the merits of the resolution, but rather a move to table it. We shall see. In any case, for years, just about every job description demanded that applicants be able to multitask. Outside of work, being able to do many things at once, like driving or eating and scheduling that doctor's appointment, gave us all a sense of getting more done, but research says we're not. We're just doing more things worse. It's gotten so out of hand that even researchers in Australia, I think it was, are blaming our smartphone addiction for horns that are growing in the back of young people's skulls. We mentioned this.
Yeah,
saying that
Washington
tilting,
Post.
Right, that our heads downward all the time is creating bone mass. Before multitasking was part of the lexicon, we called doing everything at once juggling, I think, which may be more apt because it pretty much guarantees we're going to slip up and something is going to get dropped. So what is it going to take to get back to a life of monotasking, or even should we? Is it possible? Here is in Studio 3 for her take on this is Harvard historian Nancy Kane. Nancy holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. Her latest book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Hello, Nancy Kane.
Hey there.
Well, as one who spends an awful lot of time ironing while doing other things, I find it near impossible to think people are going to go back to monotasking. What do you think?
Well, people have always, I mean, that's a little different than that, you know, I have these pictures of my mother ironing on Sunday night and watching 60 Minutes,
right?
And then later the Forsyte Saga and the first iterations of Masterpiece Theater, upstairs, downstairs, and a great fondness for that. She always had music or the television on when she ironed. Women on the frontier, Laura Ingalls Wilder, Ma wasn't just ironing, right? Sometimes she was going over to check the kettle boiling on the fire. So I think we want to be careful here. We're not talking about that is technically multitasking, but multi meaning usually more than one other thing that we are doing. Incidentally, there's unequivocal research now. If you want to read about it, my friends, there's a great article in, actually, believe it or not, bear with me. It's in a Harvard publication. It's in the Harvard Gazette. It's very recent, July 2nd. Reeling in rising distracted driving deaths. There's very good evidence that when you drive, doing anything else, talking on the phone, playing music.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, talking on the phone, talking to someone in the passenger seat is actually very, very distracting and greatly increases the odds of an accident because driving, unlike ironing, and unlike Ma spinning on the spinning wheel, has, right, the need for absolute focus built into it because of the nature of its – because it's unpredictable nature. Because real time, oops, there's someone stopped ahead. Or oops, look at that person who just ran across in the middle of the intersection. And if you're not paying attention, right, the stakes are high and the costs are very high. So I think we're not talking about – the same thing as ironing here. We're talking about people mostly on their smartphones trying to do at least three things at once. And all of us, it turns out, if you survey Americans and all over the world, are very prone to this.
You know, one of the interesting things, the most obvious example of multitasking, which I assume the average listener here would say, I agree, is a problem, is texting while driving, which is one of the reasons why our state finally joined other states in outlawing. Remember that study we saw out of Virginia Tech years ago, Marjorie, that said that texting while driving was as dangerous as drinking while driving?
Well, there's a lot of research that has now substantiated that.
But the most interesting part of this, I want to read one paragraph from a New York Times piece we were looking at. Everyone knows texting behind the wheel is dangerous, but listening to music or chatting with a passenger, as you mentioned, seems as undemanding as to be innocuous. And then there's a great point.
Yet both measurably
compromise driving. If that's surprising, consider whether you've ever turned down the radio or shushed passengers when the road turned icy or when you were looking for an address. Everybody does that.
Everyone does, even though
you would say listening to music doesn't really distract me, it's not a problem. That is a wonderful example. I always do that. You turn off the radio, even if it's music.
It's
which
a
is
wonderful
focus.
Isn't that funny?
And P.S., this article I just referenced on this point from the Harvard Gazette said that even though traffic fatalities actually have declined in the United States, that's about 38,000 people a year who die as a result of traffic accidents, cyclists and pedestrian deaths are up. about 10%. And researchers, these are people from the National Safety Council. These are not just psychologists studying or time management experts studying multitasking or neurologists, more on the brain damage, literally demonstrated brain damage that is happening now with heavy use of multitasking. Even they have clearly related this to folks on their phones while they're driving email, right? Even checking your GPS turns out to be kind of dangerous. So we've got Houston, we have a problem. I want to say something, and I want to mention one other really memorable example. This I found in the Harvard Health publishing website. This is about the mental hazards of doctors multitasking, because doctors turn out now to have an enormous amount of functions in their medical work, from prescribing drugs to scheduling surgery to leveling off or changing dosage for patients. They now do it on their smartphone. So here's an example. I just want to read this very briefly. This is a patient who goes in. He has advanced dementia, and he's going in to have a feeding tube placed in his stomach. The first thing they do when he gets in is to change his blood, is to affect his blood thinner medication, which is a drug called warfarin. Using her cell phone, the resident then begins to make a change, which is that the attending physician has asked that the blood thinner dosage be reduced. The resident begins to make the change via computerized order system, entry order system on her phone. Partway through, she receives a text from a friend inviting her to a party. She responds to the text, but forgot to go back and complete the medication order, canceling warfarin. As a result, the man kept getting this very high dosage. His blood became so thin that 2 days later, blood was spontaneously filling the sac around his heart, squeezing it so it couldn't pump properly. He needed open-heart surgery to drain the blood and save his life. Well, I don't know how many of you have been to your physician recently, but let me tell you, they're all on their phones or their iPads quite a lot. So we don't think about this when we think about multitasking, but doctors are doing it too, and this is no laughing matter. So,
you know what the ultimate multitasking was? Remember the doctor who went to the ATM while his patient was under anesthesia?
Or the doctors that were the Globe discovered
that was Mass General, wasn't it?
They were operating on two patients
right.
at once.
Right, that was Mass General.
That was Mass General.
Places.
So, can I ask you a question?
So these are the kind of dramatic dangers.
Yeah. Let me focus. I would bet until Margie and I first talked about something like this, maybe 5-10 years ago on the radio. I always thought multitasking was a sign of great intelligence
and lots of
efficiency, et cetera. So I'm assuming before these studies started coming out, you know, 5-10 years ago, there were probably people you've studied in history who one of their calling cards, I'm guessing, you'll tell me if I'm wrong, was that they could do so many things at once. Is that true or am I wrong?
Well, here's what I would say. I would say that the people I have studied in history, right? In fact, I was just at a very interesting regenerative medicine conference talking about Shackleton, because the doctors, investors, entrepreneurs, right, folks that study stem cell with great expertise in stem cell research, all they wanted to talk about leadership in high risk environments. And so they wanted to talk about Shackleton. And so one of the things we talked about was focus. How critically important it is in a high-risk situation, whether it's the Cuban Missile Crisis or it's, my goodness, what's going to happen with this FDA study, or how are we going to keep the team together when we're being buffeted by so many kind of negative forces, which happens in many, many early startup environments. They're focused, Jim, so they can do different things. But when they're doing it, they're like, you know, they're like Eckhart Tolle in The Power of Now. They are right there and completely there. Completely there. And if you read, I'm about to write a case with a colleague of mine, Eugene Kogan, at the Kennedy School, about the Cuban Missile Crisis and what we can learn about emotional awareness from the Kennedys, initially the two Kennedys, Robert and Jack Kennedy. They're both really important in how they kept their cool and stayed patient, right, against the kind of hurry up, let's get the airstrikes going kind of rule of the order of the day from most of the members initially and later in the 13 days from the XCOM. And this ability to just stay on topic, stay on high risk issue is really critical. And see, multitasking, as we're now all practicing it, is not that. Now, did Lincoln then shift from one thing, hey, this is what's going on with, you know, Joseph Hooker over here after Chancellorsville, and then shift to something else in the same afternoon? You bet. But while we were on Hooker and his problem with his generals and Robert E. Lee's brilliance and what we're going to do about supplying the next round of battles, We are right there, and we're not anywhere else. And we're not, in that moment, checking the telegraph machine, which would have been the equivalent of a cell phone, to see what else we need to be concerned with.
You mentioned Nancy Kane brain damage involved with multitasking. What do you mean?
So it turns out that different parts of the, forgive me, the frontal cortex turn out in people who do an enormous amount of multitasking, right, to suffer deterioration. Tissue starts eating away at itself. Like the brain, with the exception of about 2.5% of the population, there are people out there genetic, we think they're genetically disposed, who are multitask masters, but they are less than 2.5% of the population. If you want to read about these people, you can read the New Yorker article called Multitask Masters by Maria Konnikova, K-O-N-N-I-K-O-V-A, May 7th, 2014. Everyone, by the way, everyone thinks they're good at multitasking, right? We all have this overconfidence that we can handle it behind the wheel. The other guy can't, but we can, right? But we're not. Only 2.5% can do this. What's so interesting is that for most of us, right, this is exceptionally difficult to do. And we are actually, because the brain isn't wired to focus on so many things at once, right? Like the doctor who said, oops, what was I doing before I said yes to that RSVP on the party, right? Our brains actually physically, physiologically suffer. Last point on this, there's a new burgeoning field of research about the relationship between early onset of dementia and Alzheimer's and multitasking. Now, okay, that's all the scary stuff. So let me say something about these dramatic kind of physical and medical and traffic issues. Now, as all our listeners know, we've talked about, I coach executives. I do a lot of coaching in the summer. Here's what I have been hearing for the last 6 months anecdotally from people at executive levels of a variety of different kinds of enterprises, executive levels. These are not just the C-suite, the layer of people below those folks. By 3 o'clock in the middle of the afternoon, I don't know what end is up. I know I need to make decisions quickly. I know I've got 17 things on my desk. I have really lost my focus, and I'm completely in reactive mode. I hear that in different words, over and over and over again. And then you say to people, so what's going on there? Why is your focus suffering? Why are you getting more distracted? Why do you think you're moving too quickly on certain decisions? Why are you forgetting things? Because we're all talking about early onsets of dementia because our memories are so bad. Most of this is about multitasking. And they all say, I just get in that mode and I stay in that. That is directly related to the kind of multitasking game that every time we open our smartphone or every time we look in our inbox is presented to us. By the way, instead of, hey, I'll take that question, I'll take, you know, what's in literature for 60, and then you get some money as if it's a Jeopardy game. I'm talking about as a game show, right? What comes to us is dopamine. The reward is dopamine. So every time we go, yes, I just responded, including the doctor saying yes to the party, right? We get a shot of dopamine. And so we feel there's a part of us that feels really cool and literally physically a little tiny better because we are multitasking. But, you know, you feel good smoking cigarettes and you feel good having the third gin and tonic. Doesn't mean it's so great for us short term and long term. So I think a whole bunch of things are suffering. Most importantly, focus, patience, retention, memory, and a sense of the ability to see the larger picture of what's going on, because multitasking asks you to be involved in the forest and the leaves of these different issues right now, and then to move to a larger forest of leaves and trees. And no one, I worry not only are we growing horns on the back of our neck, we're not looking up and seeing and taking in what's going on in the big picture.
So last question, is there any research on what people should do? Should they read a book and shut their smartphones and TVs off? Should they try to relearn their ability to concentrate?
Yes, so there is research, yes. A lot of it has to do, first and foremost, with discipline, like almost like trying to at least lower the addiction intensity of your relationship with your phone. By the way, 67% of Americans take their phone into the bathroom, just to give you just a tiny taste of this.
No, it's actually 68% because I do too.
Okay, so and a slightly larger group, right, sleep with their phone and right next to their bed and reach for their phone before they reach for anything else, partners, dogs, water in the morning. So the early research says figure out a way, leave the phone, turn the phone over and only check email on a scheduled basis. The average American spends, incidentally, dear listeners, about 30% of their work week looking at email.
Wow.
Hard to
Not
cure
Marjorie.
Hard to cure
we don't
cancer.
Have to worry about her.
How
Not-
to cure cancer and build a more divided, coherent, neighborly nation when we're all so reactive, distracted, and this. So first, phone discipline, experimenting with that. It's a habit. Dopamine is addictive. We have to figure out how we're going to break it. I've done some of the work anecdotally with executives. Phone discipline is really important. Incidentally, if you start a meeting and you turn and the leader of the meeting or the most high-ranking person in the room turns their phone over and puts it in the center of the table, right? Everyone will do it, and the meeting will be shorter and much more efficient. The research on that is unequivocal. Second thing, think about starting your morning. I've said this before because I'm doing it, and I've been using it with my executives, and it seems to have some traction, is start your morning but without your phone. For the first 5 minutes, have your coffee, 10 minutes, and just don't look at your phone and do some kind, create some kind of space in your head with yourself that's slow and not necessarily moving you into that reactive game show right away. Third, there's some really interesting work being done now about taking a walk, just breaking the cycle of the game show bells and dopamine and increasing numbers of things you're attending to at the same time by taking a walk. Steve Jobs used to do this all the time at Apple. He'd say, we need a walk. I'm going to walk around Cupertino. Right? He became famous for it. Some of what he was doing was resetting his brain. And fourth is what does it mean? There's an interesting, very self-indulgent story that I would recommend to you, despite the self-indulgence and the worldliness, called, bear with me, it's from Wired, Going Dumb, My Year with a Flip Phone, about what it's like to live without an iPhone. It's actually 8 months. It's from 12/19/2018 by Jason Kahe, K-E-H-E. Here are two things that come out of it that I thought were kind of profound and kind of sad that they become profound. He doesn't have a GPS, and since he's locationally challenged, he says, I have to ask for directions. And he starts to realize that people will give you directions, and you can have a connection with someone that isn't purely transactional by just walking across the parking lot and saying, how do I get onto the highway? So that was really interesting. And the second really interesting moment is he discovers a more expansive interpersonal morality because he's not on text. You see, you know, we have this whole thing about if someone doesn't send you back a text right away, and if they don't, you know, they don't have the whole text like emoji lingo right, you start getting angry. And then I realized that without text, like, it's actually like a little bit, you know, messier and easier to just like let people be and not expect Patricia to respond in 30 seconds. And he discovers his whole sense that there's a little more slack in interpersonal relations when they aren't brokered purely through our smartphones. And that got me to thinking, last point, I wonder if our political division, our lack of neighborliness, the increasing divisiveness that we can't stop talking about and we can't stop observing on the roads and in our politics isn't partly related to how much we're, how many relationships we're brokering and how much we're in a transactional, reactive, show it to me now mode that isn't giving us enough space to just let us all be the messy human, right, longing for connection beings that we really are.
Nancy Kahn, thank you
as always.
Very much. Harvard historian Nancy Kahn joins us every week. She holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. Her latest book, Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Nancy, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nancy.
Coming up, we are opening the lines and asking you about multitasking. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Harvard Business School's Nancy Kahn about multitasking. And now we're opening the lines and talking to you about it. Are you ready to become a monotasker? Do you even think you need to become one? Are you hooked on multitasking? Do you believe you're actually getting more done? I think Nancy's right. Most of us think we are the exception, that we can do it. The number is 877-301-8970. I don't think I ever, I'm not proud of this. You know, when Nancy was describing like laser-like focus of great leaders who, when they decide to dig in, they focus, you know, incredibly. I can't think of anything. You know what's a good example, by the way? You do a wonderful job of checking the email. We have callers. You and I are talking about things that matter. And at the same time, you're reading email. I checked the internet. When Nancy was talking, I knew we were going to be discussing this. I just checked a story. Well, it doesn't work. It really doesn't work, even though each of us, most of us, me included, have convinced ourselves that not only are we good at multitasking, but there's a great story in that New York Times thing I was quoting before. People don't multitask solely because they see no harm in it. They perceive benefits. I am one who unwisely does perceive benefits. I think I can do two things at once. All research suggests I do both things more poorly because I am doing them both at once.
Well, you know something? I do iron, like I said, and I will talk on the phone. I have headsets, and I'll talk on the phone and fold clothes and stuff like that if I'm talking to people on the phone. But I just because I've been a newspaper reporter and a writer all my life, I have to turn off the phone if I'm going to try to get anything done writing a story. I have to turn off the phone and just concentrate because maybe, I don't know, it's hard and painful for me to concentrate. And I notice the difference in the quality of the column or the story.
Do you have the radio on in the background?
Nope.
You don't have music on in the background?
Nope.
Because these studies also suggest that music, which most of us think is a healthy and helpful environmental thing, is actually distracting as well.
Nope.
You don't?
No.
Well, good for you.
And if I was getting close to deadline when I was at the Herald and I was nervous about not making deadline, I take my story into the bathroom and work it out in the bathroom really? So nobody could interrupt me.
Okay. We want to know what you do. Are you multitaskers out there? And if you are, have you convinced yourself you can live better, do things, two things,
although,
three things at once?
On the other hand, the idea of driving somewhere and not being able to listen to the radio or listen to a podcast or call people on the telephone would be too much for me.
Jeannie in North Attleboro, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hi. Hi. I'm just giving a point about how children are so used to us multitasking, and I'm an extremely bad offender of the whole thing of multitasking. But I spend usually one day a week with my granddaughter. She's three. And if I have my phone in my hand, she can't see me, but she keeps saying, "Stop looking at your phone. Stop looking at your phone." She's so used to grown-ups doing it, she automatically assumes that's what we're doing.
You know, Jeannie, I think that's one of the saddest things about childhood now is that before cell phones, if you went to the park with your kid or your grandkid or whoever, you were in the park. And now I see all these mothers and fathers with their cell phones as they're with a stroller down the street. They got the kid in one hand. They got the cell phone in the other hand. I mean, it's like there's no break. I'm with your three-year-old. I think it's awful.
Well, I need to leave it in my pocket and not look at it. I also probably just need to say, you don't need to take it outside for the next 45 minutes. But it's a bad habit, and I'm as guilty as anybody.
You know, Jeannie, thanks for the call. The most important, the most significant abuser of monotasking is something on the cell phone. And I've told the story a million times. You know, I went to Costa Rica for a week, about 2-3 years ago, and I was literally hyperventilating because I knew I had to be off the grid. I had no choice. It was not like this is a nice thing to do, enjoy the wilderness. It was because there's no service there. I was in panic, and I was totally convinced when I got back, I think San Jose is the capital. Is that the name?
I think it is.
When
idea.
I got back to San Jose and had service, that I was getting 4,000 messages and horrible things had happened because I couldn't. I did have 4,000 or 300 or whatever I had. Well, many more than 300. Not one of those things, not one, couldn't have waited as it did for a week. And the smartphone is the worst thing that ever happened to focus in our lives. Would you not agree?
What's wrong with checking your email every 3 hours?
What?
What's wrong with checking?
I'm trying to limit it to every 3 minutes, and I would think I'd feel really... Caroline Roslindale, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about multitasking. Hi.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You guys are awesome.
Thanks.
I'm a Montessori teacher.
Oh.
Preschool to 3 to 6-year-olds. I don't know if you know a lot about Montessori, but
yes.
There's a lot of children. I have 27 children, and they're each doing their own thing at the same time. So as a Montessori teacher, you have to multitask, and you have to be good at it. So I think there's a place for multitasking when it's obviously part of your job or you need to be doing it. But I also meditate in the morning. I teach meditation to my children, and I have them pause and breathe, and I teach them to breathe. So we're kind of resetting our focus. Mm. So I'm kind of teaching. I'm multitasking, but I'm also teaching one-pointed focus at the same time, which is very important in Montessori, actually.
Oh, you've got it together there. Sounds very impressive. Thank you very
much. But by the way, obviously it's a conscious act on your part to be doing that. The reason you do it is in part because of the multitasking thing you're talking about, right? To compensate for it, is that not the notion?
I think I do. You mean teaching it to the children?
Yeah. Well, I mean for you, because you're the one who has to multitask, because as you say, you have almost 30 kids who are all doing different things, which is part of the whole point there. So does it help you be better able to do that which we say can't be done, multitasking?
I think it does. I think if you can train your brain to be able to pause consciously and multitask consciously, then you can. Yeah, definitely. I think you can do it, and you can find ways to train your brain to be able to do it. But yes, I think you have to do it consciously and take breaks and actually watch yourself with the phone and the other things that don't fit in, you know, that you shouldn't really be doing.
Carla,
not doing it when you shouldn't be doing it.
Thank you for your call. We really appreciate it. It's a very thoughtful approach to the problem.
There's been a lot of studies that say meditating changes your brain structure.
Is that what you do? Is that what that's
I'm
called?
I'm a meditator. Yes, I am.
You are.
Yes,
well, that's really helped you calm
it
down,
has helped
I should
me,
say.
I must say.
Really?
You can imagine what I'd be like without it, Jim.
Milkweed is in Wetwilgoid. Had you not been meditating, you might not have known that earlier in the
Robert says he's multitasking right at this instant, Jim. He's listening to you right now. He's watching the Best of Brady reruns on NACN and reading Jim's autobiography. It's all about me. The hell with the rest of you. Thank you, Robert.
I haven't written that yet, but that is the working title of, you know, by the way, that's an interesting question. Every single person who is listening to us talking about multitasking is multitasking. Nobody is just sitting, I assume, calmly, including Carla, and peacefully and doing nothing, but let me focus on Jim and Marjorie's show and their callers.
Well, they figure
they're
driving
minutes.
In the car.
Well, that's multitasking.
Or they're cleaning the house, or they're doing things around the house. Or I mean,
can I? I'm so glad you say you're the one that usually brings this up. By the way, I rail against texting while driving. I used to be a horrible abuser, and I am humiliated that I was. I am much better now. It is a deadly habit. I know it is. But you're the one who always interrupts and says it's not just that. People say. And I've celebrated the notion that we now have hands-free phone use with very limited exceptions. And you've made the point that talking alone, it's not just holding the thing in your hand, the conversation in and of itself,
right,
even with a fellow passenger, is distracting based on the research.
Well, this New York Times story that talks about the high price of multitasking says that if you are in a stressful situation with driving, you should turn off everything. Turn off the radio, no music, nothing.
Well, that's why people do what I said before. When it's an icy street or whatever it is that I mentioned a minute ago, you're looking for an address, you ask people to be quiet or you turn off the radio.
And it is true. I mean, you notice this from driving. Someone can turn on the brakes in front of you like in an instant.
Yeah.
And if you look away for an instant, you look back up again in that instant, you're half the distance to the car you were before. You know, it does, especially if you're going 60 miles an hour down the highway.
Do you know anybody who doesn't? I mean, we had, I think, one caller. Do you know anybody who doesn't multitask and who hasn't convinced themselves that they can do it well enough? I don't mean just driving. Driving's a
Well, like I said before,
example.
I think that I've learned that I cannot anyway. Maybe other people can. I cannot concentrate really
intently.
Oh, and
that one limited. Okay, fine. When you're writing
with music or sound or anybody interrupting me or anything, but I don't know if that's unusual or if lots of people have managed to do it. I just can't. Mary on the road.
Hello,
Mary. What do you think, Mary?
Hi. You know, the thing for me is I am definitely a multitasker, and it's a problem because I can see that I drop balls every now and then. But you know, I think as somebody who's aging, I'm going to be looking at 70 pretty soon. I feel that I need to stay on top of technology and keep up with what the young people are doing, or I'm going to be marginalized.
Yeah, but you can do that as a solo takeaway rather than integrating it into a whole set of things you're doing simultaneously, right?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, it seems like if you want to stay very involved with things, you're going to be doing a lot of things at once. That's how society is running now. So whether it's, you know, being involved in volunteer work and other things around the home and things with family, paying bills, I feel like I'm in the middle of all the things all the time, almost always.
So how effective?
On the computer.
How effective at these multiple tasks do you feel you are when you're doing all, when you're balance, you're juggling all these balls simultaneously, Mary?
It depends on the day. Some days I am awesome, and other days, no, forget about it.
I would say, I would not use the word awesome, but I to describe my ability on a good day to do it, but I'm exactly, I think, like you. Some days it works pretty well for me, despite what the research suggests, and some days it's a disaster. Mary, thank you for the
call. And when it's a disaster, what does that mean?
That nothing is, everything is getting short shrift. Nothing is being done at the level of competence and efficiency that it and attention that it deserves. Everything is a B or a C, rather than one thing being an A minus or what. You don't have those. I mean, you have this. You tell me to shut up often. I mean, in the morning when we're preparing for the show, I'm usually, while I'm reading, I'm talking to you, I'm talking to Chelsea, talking to one of our coworkers, and usually interrupting you in the middle of your reading. And occasionally, more than occasionally, you respectfully say to me, I got to read this stuff. That's your attempt to monotask,
yeah,
is
well,
it not?
Yes. Well, obviously I said that I need non-interruption to concentrate, but I don't know if that's typical or unusual.
Like when I said to you, a good example, this morning I said to you, when will we be discussing Airbnb? And oh no, it was you that said that. It was not. I forgot that was not me. You're
Valerie in Marblehead, thank you for calling.
We're doing Airbnb tomorrow.
Yeah, we're doing
Airbnb
tomorrow, and it's an unbelievable operation. You know, you get the nice place, and
you get a
keg
with you.
Beer.
It's amazing. Hi, Valerie.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
Good. Well, I guess I am multitasking. I'm sitting in a parking lot, ready to go into a store, listening to your radio. I've become, as a senior citizen, more disciplined about my time and not scheduling so many things at once. I'd rather do something every day. And also with my phone, I never have my ringer or the vibrator on unless I know specifically I'm expecting a call. I read my emails on my iPad in the morning, and when I go upstairs to get ready to go out, it stays upstairs till about 11 o'clock at night. I purposely, when I come home from errands after supper, I read for at least 2 hours or more.
Wow.
And then I might check my email before I go to bed. I have friends that are very upset with me, like, what if there's an emergency, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, the Marblehead police can always come to my door and knock in the middle of the night.
I'm sorry to cut you off. We're out of time. But she is doing exactly what, I mean, to answer your question for Nancy of 20-some minutes ago, she's segregating each of her activities and focusing on each one and then moving on to the next one.
But also she said she's older. I think the people that are really doing this, you know, to excess are in younger 20s and 30s, because that's the way they've grown up, you know, and they can't be without their
Well, the woman who called before said the older she gets, the more she feels to stay in touch. She's got a multitask too, so I'm not sure it's just generational.
Okay, we are done. Thanks
we
for
are
listening
done.
To another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can catch us 24/7 by way of our podcast. Tune in tomorrow for legal writer Emily Bazelon, Bill McKibben on his latest book, and novelist T.C. Boyle. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Arjun Singh, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubele. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. What's on TV, Jim?
Well, I assume you know the Department of Justice has cited no charges in the death of Eric Garner yesterday. We know that there are no criminal charges against the cops involved in the choking death of Garner. I'm going to talk to Michael Curry and some other people about how these constant events of no accountability, no liability in these deaths, how it's changing policing, how it's changing the reaction of African Americans in this country to police, and a variety of other things like that. Ted Johnson won a couple of Super Bowls, I think maybe even three with the Patriots. He's been a critic, though, of the NFL and how they've treated people with head injuries like him, by the way, and he's now lobbying for two really important pieces of legislation for those with brain injuries on Beacon Hill. Ted's going to join me tonight. Stephanie Lydon's got a piece about bullying, but sort of the cyberbullying side, which obviously is particularly problematic, particularly for those with disabilities. And I'm going to talk about one of your favorite people in my commentary, Lindsey Graham, Marjorie.
Oh, love
That's
him.
Tonight at 7
love
o'clock.
Him.
Before we go, by the way, next week, Marjorie and I are going to go out to Tanglewood to do some reporting and do some packages for radio and TV. But I want to tell you, this Friday at 8 o'clock on Boston Common is a fabulous program called Tanglewood in the City. In Boston. It's a live concert from Tanglewood. You can see her go to bso.org/Tanglewood in the City. It's spectacular. It's the fourth year. Don't miss it.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a wonderful afternoon.